the very worst of the internet.
They would visualize certain pieces of content that they had removed over and over again every time they closed their eyes.
The Moderators, next Monday to Friday afternoon at 1:45 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
It's 6 o'clock on Tuesday, the 5th of November. This is Today with Justin Webb in Washington, D.C. and Michelle Hussein in London.
The top headline this morning, it is Decision Day in America as the United States chooses between Donald Trump and Kamala Harris. Millions are preparing to go to the polls in the most closely fought presidential race of recent times. I've been speaking to voters in the swing states of Pennsylvania and North Carolina.
Madam Vice President has made it a point to reach out to everyone.
The only candidate on the ticket that is representing my values and Latino values is Donald Trump today.
When all the votes are counted, that's what matters to me, because ain't nobody called my house and asked me who I was voting for.
We'll hear from a senior Democrat and from a key advisor to the Trump campaign and why it could be a few days before we know the winner.
Also in today's programme, the Health Secretary Wes Streeting on banning the legal sale of cigarettes and also disposable vapes. And Sir Chris Hoy's call for earlier prostate cancer screening and his own life-changing diagnosis.
The stakes are much higher now. It felt like life and death in the moment when you're battling it out for an Olympic gold medal, but the stakes have changed dramatically and it is life and death. But I guess the principle is the same. It's about focusing on what you have control over and not worrying about the stuff that you can't control.
The BBC News is read by Alan Smith.
The candidates in the US presidential election have made their final pitches to voters, with millions expected to head to the polls in the coming hours. The outcome is predicted to be tight and is highly likely to be decided by seven swing states, with opinion polling suggesting no clear victor. Donald Trump, the Republican candidate, made Michigan his final stop, where he pledged to lead the US to new heights of glory. He was boosted by an endorsement from the influential podcaster Joe Rogan. Our correspondent Ione Wells sent this report from Michigan.
When I spoke to Donald Trump supporters in the queue for his final rally, the same themes came up again and again. Close the borders, improve the economy. It's no surprise when speaking to his fans that he chose to focus on immigration and the economy in his closing pitch.
Your paychecks will be higher, your streets will be safer and cleaner, your communities will be richer, and your future will be brighter than ever before. This will be the golden age of America.
He also used the final day of his campaign to repeat unfounded claims that his opponents were cheating. His critics say he's laying the ground to challenge the result if he loses. His last rally in Michigan was in a city that was once a Republican stronghold, but turned Democrat in 2020. In other parts of the state that used to be Democrat, voters have told me they're switching to Donald Trump because they back his immigration and economic policies. As one put it, the former president has redefined the party here. Soon we will know if that has worked in his favour or to his detriment.
Kamala Harris focused her final effort in Philadelphia in Pennsylvania, saying her campaign appealed to the aspirations and dreams of the American people. Our correspondent Tom Bateman was watching.
Welcome the next president of these United States, Kamala Harris!
Well, the crowd is many thousand strong in perhaps the most critical of swing states, and their candidate is making her way to the stage.
America is ready for a fresh start, ready for a new way forward where we see our fellow American not as an enemy, but as a neighbor. And we are ready for a president who knows that the true measure of a leader is not based on who you beat down, but based on who you lift up.
The speech was focused on optimism and hope. In reality, both campaigns have dwelt on claims of dystopian prospects if they lose. While Kamala Harris has outperformed Joe Biden's poll ratings before the Democrats ousted him as their candidate, she hasn't broken the deadlock with Donald Trump.
The Polish authorities have warned that incendiary packages placed on cargo flights earlier this year were possible practice runs by Russia's spy agency for attacks on transatlantic planes. One package caught fire in a warehouse in Birmingham in July, another on the ground in Germany, and two more were found in Poland. Russia has denied involvement. Here's our security correspondent Frank Gardner.
More details are now emerging about a series of arson attacks that Western intelligence officials suspect were part of an orchestrated campaign by Russia's military intelligence agency, the GRU. The authorities in Poland now believe this was a practice run for future devices to be placed on planes bound for the US and Canada. Packages containing erotic gadgets and massage pillows appear to have been used as cover to smuggle highly dangerous incendiary devices onto cargo routes destined for Western Europe. One ignited at a DHL warehouse outside Birmingham, another in Leipzig in Germany, a third in Warsaw, and a fourth was intercepted by the Polish authorities.
Workers at Boeing have voted to accept a deal to end a 7-week walkout. More than half backed the agreement, which will see them receive a 38% pay rise during the next 4 years. A BBC investigation has found senior doctors are charging the NHS premier rates for overtime, with some making more than £200,000 extra every year for the additional work. That's almost double the average pay for a full-time consultant in England. Here's our health correspondent, Nick Triggle.
The government has made tackling the hospital backlog a priority, promising to put on extra clinics at weekends and evenings in England. But the BBC investigation found the NHS is having to pay the most senior doctors significant sums to do additional work. Rates exceeding £200 an hour, more than four times normal pay, are being charged. The British Medical Association defended the rates, saying staffing shortages were to blame. Hospitals said covering strikes and sickness absence were also factors, and they were trying to bear down on the highest rates of pay.
The government has announced plans to extend the smoking ban in enclosed public places in England to outdoor areas close to schools, hospitals and children's playgrounds. Vaping could also be barred in these areas, but ministers have decided not to outlaw smoking in pub gardens. The six-time Olympic cycling champion Sir Chris Hoy says he wants young men to be screened for prostate cancer to try to save millions of lives. In his first in-depth interview since making his terminal diagnosis public, Sir Chris, who's 48, said he hoped there would be a surge of people coming forward for a blood test. In particular, he wants those with a family history of prostate cancer to be screened.
It's logical to me that why would you not just get the test a little bit earlier, catch it before you need to have any major treatment. So it's, to me, it seems a no-brainer. Why would they not allow more men to just go in and get a blood test? Maybe people seeing this or hearing about my story and then just by them asking their GP will create enough of a surge of interest that the people that make decisions will go, do you know what, we need to address this.
That was Sir Chris Hoy.
Alan, thank you very much. 6:07. Simon King is at the BBC Weather Centre for us this morning. Hello, Simon.
Hi, Michelle. Good morning. It's a familiar story, I think, weather-wise across the United Kingdom. Lots of cloud once again, some mist and some fog patches this morning. So let's start off in southwest, southeast and eastern England, where we've got that mist and fog, particularly so over the hills towards southwest England, around Devon, especially this morning. The visibilities should improve gradually in the coming hours as the mist and fog lifts up. But once again, it's going to be grey and overcast for all through most of today. Maximum temperatures getting up to about 13 degrees in Norwich, 14 in London and Bath, and 16 Celsius in Plymouth. For Wales and the Midlands, again, some mist and a few fog patches, especially on the hills this morning. Much of this will eventually clear away, and again, it's going to be a mostly cloudy day. However, there may well be some breaks in the cloud across North and East Wales, so perhaps a bit of brightness here at temperatures of about 14 degrees in Cardiff, 13 in Birmingham. For Northwest and Northeast England, mist and again some hill fog patches this morning, clearing to leave a mostly overcast morning. Some brighter intervals perhaps later on, with temperatures of 13 degrees in Manchester and Leeds and 12 Celsius in Newcastle. For Northern Ireland, central and southern Scotland, any mist clears away, mostly grey and overcast, temperatures of 12 or 13 degrees. And for northern Scotland, a bit of drizzle early on actually this morning, that's going to largely clear. And actually for northern Scotland, this is the place where we're going to see the best chance of some sunshine. So a bright afternoon with highs of 9 to 12 Celsius.
Simon, thank you. 6:09 is the time. Let's have our first look at the papers. The Guardian saying the US is facing its moment of reckoning as voters choose either Kamala Harris or Donald Trump as their new president. The paper calls it an election like none before, with a choice between a black woman and a former president branded a fascist by his own former officials.
The headline for The Eye is America decides the world holds its breath. It suggests that global leaders from Moscow and Kiev to Beijing and Tehran are waiting to discover the future of the US. The editor Oliver Duff suggests Kamala Harris has fought an unimpressive campaign, but he points out the alternative is returning a convicted criminal to the White House.
The Mirror's opinion column simply states, let's hope it's Kamala. It concludes that Donald Trump is no friend of Britain. But The Sun seizes on a comment by Mr. Trump that the election is ours to lose, as he put it. It says the former president insists he's on the verge of an historic comeback.
The Financial Times has front page pictures of Harris and Trump side by side. It says, although the polls are razor thin, the Democrats have been cheered by what they believe is a decided shift towards their candidate.
Here in the US, the Washington Post tells Americans to keep their heads on election night. Its key piece of advice is to be patient as early results come in. These may, it says, not be indicative of the final outcome, as happened in 2020 when postal ballots hadn't been counted and Donald Trump thought that he had won.
The New York Times looks at the substance of Mr. Trump's campaign, declaring there is one wrinkle with his insistence that he will fix America's problems. They've already been fixed, it says, more or less. It says inflation, illegal immigration and crime are all down, although it admits that any of them could be improved further.
And comments by Nigel Farage, a Trump ally, make the lead for the Daily Telegraph. It reports that Mr. Farage, who's attending Mr. Trump's Election Day party at his home in Florida, has advised his friend to accept the result of the election if he loses decisively. He's quoted saying, if that happens, Mr. Trump should go and play golf at Turnberry, something we will be putting to a key advisor to Donald Trump later on in the programme.
The Mail is unimpressed by the government's decision to allow universities in England to raise tuition fees for the first time in 8 years. The headline is, now that's what you call a U-turn.
But The Times is in favour of it. Under the headline Degree of Confidence, its opinion column argues that the cap on fees has left many universities teetering on the edge of bankruptcy. It thinks raising them amounts to a confrontation with reality.
And finally, The Sun leads on what it calls Oasis bust-up fears. It suggests the organisers of the band's forthcoming reunion tour are so worried about the possibility of a fresh feud between Liam and Noel Gallagher, they aren't going to pay the brothers their joint £6 million fee for each gig until they turn up. The headline is, be here now or you don't get paid.
12 minutes past six is the time. So the final rallies, the final messages.
My message to you and to all Americans tonight is very simple. We do not have to live this way. We don't have to live this way.
As president, I pledge to seek common ground and common sense solutions to the challenges you face.
Donald Trump ending the night in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Kamala Harris in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. The expectation is that the winner of Pennsylvania's 19 Electoral College votes will win the whole thing. Earlier in the day, with hours to go before the polls open, both candidates visiting the majority Hispanic city of Reading in Pennsylvania, where they know that small differences in small places might deliver an entire nation.
They don't do anything haphazard. This is all calculated on both parties. From what we're being told, Reading and Berks County is the nucleus that can make the difference in winning this state. And they all say it, both sides, Pennsylvania is the key to this election.
And Republicans and Democrats alike are focusing all their efforts today on getting out the vote, including at a Baptist church in North Carolina, visited by Bill Clinton. North Carolina, another swing state where I've been in the last couple of days.
Well, my family, I come from a family, we take voting very seriously. Because back in my day, we died for the right. So my family takes it very, very seriously.
Do you feel, though, that this time round there has been a reduction, which is what the polls tell us, isn't
it?
A reduction in support, particularly by young black people.
That's what the polls are saying. But November 5th, when all the votes are counted, that's what matters to me. Because ain't nobody called my house and asked me who I was voting for. So I don't put a whole lot of stock in the polls, okay?
Donald Trump probably has to win North Carolina to take the White House. The Democrats are hoping, though, that demographic change, as in some other states, might help them.
If you go back to 2008, when Barack Obama won his first term, so Virginia went blue that election for the first time in many, many years. North Carolina also went blue. And so people thought then that that was kind of the start of something big. And it just hasn't happened. And so there's this sense here, you know, the old Charlie Brown cartoon where Lucy keeps pulling the football away from him when he tries to kick it. That's kind of North Carolina Democrats.
Now, we know the polls are close. We keep talking about them being close, and they are close. But when swing states move, they tend, at least in recent times, to have moved together. So it's entirely possible that one candidate prevails relatively easily tonight. But the spectre of legal challenges, some of them already filed, does loom over the entire election. So when could we know the result?
My head and my gut tell me that if it's a close election, I would say Friday or Saturday for news organizations being comfortable enough to make a call.
There we go. America's big day underway. Polling opening in a few hours here on the East Coast.
I'm hoping we can hear again from the woman who called you baby. That's the first time I've ever heard anything of that kind.
Yes, much more excitement in the programme ahead.
It's now a 6:15. A BBC investigation has discovered how some senior doctors are being paid four times their normal rate for overtime. That's aimed at bringing waiting lists down. Nick Triggle is the BBC's health correspondent. How does this happen, Nick?
Well, I suppose the first thing is there's lots of overtime available, and the British Medical Association points this out, because of shortages of staff, as well as tackling the backlog and trying to reduce the waiting list. Consultants have been asked to fill behind vacancies and sickness absence. The strikes over the last year, the junior doctor strikes, have also added to the need. But this has had another effect. During those strikes, the British Medical Association asked its members to charge particularly high rates to cover those junior doctors who are walking out. And that seems, certainly from what hospitals have been telling me, that it's set a new expectation by consultants about what they should be charging for overtime. The way the consultant contract is organised doesn't help either. People in the NHS told me consultants can opt out of weekend working, and they only need to give their first 4 hours a week of overtime at normal rate, and then they can negotiate kind of locally what they want. And that's the same whether you're full or part-time. And a lot of the consultants earning huge sums are part-time and then doing a lot of lucrative overtime on top of that.
But what does it mean then for the taxpayer in value for money? Because we know, don't we, that the government really wants to and needs to get waiting lists down. It wants thousands of extra appointments and procedures every week. And it seems some of those procedures will be paid for at multiples of the normal rate for overtime.
Well, that's the problem. I spoke to senior people in the NHS, and their concern is there's just going to be ever more demand for overtime. And consultants, the more overtime you ask them to do, and they're doing this often at fairly unsocial hours, the more they will charge to take time away from their family and things they enjoy doing. So this is a big problem, I think the senior people in the NHS believe. One of the things is, there's been attempts to negotiate the consultant contract. This contract is more than 20 years old, but the NHS leaders say that it's just not in the interests of consultants or the British Medical Association to renegotiate it. Their basic salary is going up, and then they've got the overtime on top. So it's a really difficult situation. I mean, the obvious solution is to recruit more doctors, but governments have been trying that for the past 10, 15 years. There's hope that AI and technology may help. AI has been trialled to read diagnostic scans and stuff. And maybe other staff, speciality doctors, a grade below consultants, senior nurses may be able to take on more of a role to tackle this backlog. But it is a difficult problem to solve.
We'll have the Health Secretary Wes Streeting with us later on in the programme. Nick, thanks very much.
18 minutes past six. We have our first result, by the way, in the American presidential election. Dixville Notch, this place in New Hampshire that traditionally kicks it all off. They have only six or so votes, I think, and they count them all at the same time. By the way, it was a tie. There you go. Time for the business news now. Sean has been speaking to the man behind one of the most anticipated flotations on the London Stock Exchange this year. Hello, Sean.
Yeah, interesting one. You might be interested in this, Justin, with the gym gear, the more cash approach that you're
got on today rather than the slick shirts we'd often see here in London. Applied Nutrition, sports supplement business that's grown from a small warehouse on the edge of Liverpool and a secret factory, actually, which we'll learn more about in a moment. From that to being listed in London with a value of more than £350 million. It's attracted investment from the likes of Asda Cohen, Mohsin Issa, the former JD Sports Chief Executive Peter Cowgill, Colleen Rooney as well. Its chairman is Andy Bell, the founder of the investment platform AJ Bell. I heard the full story from Tom Ryder, who founded this Applied Nutrition business 10 years ago. He's the company's chief executive. Since listing on the stock market a couple of weeks ago, he's been on a tour of the Middle East. He chatted to me from Kuwait, and he took me right back to the very beginning in Kirby, Merseyside.
There was a shop that come available. It was like a 50-pence shop or a 20-pence shop. It just sold like junk. It was on the estate where I grew up. And I remember just ringing the landlord and saying, you know, is it available? He said, yes, it's available. I said, I wouldn't mind putting some supplements there. The rent at the time was about £90 a week, I think it was. And I said, I'll give it a go if you don't mind. Supplements were relatively unheard of back then.
When are we talking about at this point?
I must have been 17, 18, I would say.
So around the turn, yeah, around the turn of the century, yeah.
You do the maths. So I think maybe 18, let's say. And at the time, the brands that was around, we were dominated by US brands because it originated out of the US. So I started stocking US brands, and it was a bit of a side job for me because I was still a scaffolder for Liverpool Council. And then it grew. My passion for it continued to grow. I wanted to do more. I think by the age of about 24, I left the council and went full-time supplements. At that time, I was wholesaling then. So I was importing from Europe. I was wholesaling to other independent stores, gyms, etc.
So just you were doing all just before you left the council then, you were doing all of that, were you, as well as having the council job?
The Liverpool council won't be happy with me, but yeah, it's a typical council job. Yeah, I was able to do other things.
Well,
I always knew it's not something that I wanted to do forever, you know, and I wanted to do something that I loved, and I wanted to, you know, I was always looking for different things. I was also doing night school as accountancy. I was doing everything you can think of to see what is it that I want to do. And obviously the supplements would just continue to be a massive part of my life.
At what point did you then, once you've got it in-house and you're starting to recruit, are you getting to the Applied Nutrition that has listed on the London stock market?
We started reverse engineering some of our own product, reverse engineering, manufacturing some of our own products. And not only was we maintaining the cost of goods that we had previously, but we're beating them. We're bringing our cost of goods down. And then it's a completely different skill set in itself. Then you're thinking, okay, how can I keep bringing my cost of goods down even further? And it was like, okay, I need to buy better procurement. So I went into a new world of procuring ingredients. But I want to tell you something else, I've never told no one else. When you go back to them years, right, I never told anybody that we're producing in-house. So a lot of our customers and partners didn't know because they didn't want them to ever think it's crap. If it's being produced in Kirby by a little brand called Applied, it's crap. So I let people think, I never told them that we wasn't producing, but I let them think it was still being produced in this white label manufacturer in Belgium. It was like, you know, the best within Europe. I let them think that it was all being produced there, but it wasn't. It was being produced in-house by us in the most compliant way. You know, we're even from that little room that we had, we still had them credentials that we've got today because we set it up for knowing that it has to be. We have to resonate trust. It has to be to the highest level of quality. But nobody knew that. Nobody knew for quite a few years until we got to a stage where we grew it that big, where we were like, invite people down, show them what we're doing.
Why did you want to list on the London Stock Exchange?
You have to be in the industry to understand that. The global credibility that gives you as being a listed business is just on another level. You look at some of the globally dominating brands within our industry, and they are PLCs, and I think they're seen within a different league. Our objective is to become the world's most trusted and innovative sports nutrition, health and wellness brands. And if we ever want to achieve that, which we absolutely will, we need to be in that league. So back in 2021, I was like, it was a dream then. And then, you know, you fast forward to August 23, and we're looking at our options, and we have plenty of options around us. We did, and we were like, okay, but let's explore the option of IPO. So we went and spoke to a few people like Andy Bell, Peter Cowgill, and we said, give us the ups and downs, give us the pros and cons. We want to know what's good and what's not about being a listed business. by the time we'd finished speaking with those guys, it was like, we have to pursue this. This is for us.
So you're name dropping now, Tom. So I'm gonna just, you know, people maybe in the investment world might be familiar with these names, but tell us about Andy Bell.
So I'll be honest with you, Sean, I didn't know anything about him at that point. I just knew that we're looking at our options to IPO. Andy's a local guy to us. It was only when we took note of being a PLC or you know, the options of being a PLC, we're like, okay, we look at AJ Bell. AJ Bell's a massively successful PLC. Let's go and speak to him. Andy, being the gentleman he is, you know, he didn't know us. He welcomed us into his house. He gave us the good and bad. He never mixed his words. We took it all on board and we're like, this is something we're going to do. Then Andy approached us and said, I'm massively impressed with your business. I'd love to be a part of it. So we're like, brilliant.
Big debate over the last year or two has been the London stock market and whether businesses around the world and even businesses that are growing quickly in the UK are convinced that London is the place to be. Have you, as you've gone through this process, caught wind of that conversation? Is London the right place to be?
Absolutely. And like I said, we spoke to a few people and some people were quite negative against the London Stock Exchange. And then we spoke to two massively successful people who run PLCs on the London Stock Exchange. And they were absolutely positive. Their advice was, you do things in the right way. You respect the market. You respect the investors. You don't be too greedy. You bring governance into your company. It'll be right for you. And we're like, okay, this is absolutely what we want to do. We want to become a better company. You know, let's embrace it.
Have you taken stock of the budget in the UK while you've been on your travels?
I haven't looked at it. And I always say, you know, no matter what the government implements, we welcome it with open arms. We embrace it. Nothing's going to surprise us. And we'll work with the government. We'll work, you know, we'll embrace it. So I haven't actually took much notice of what's being implemented, to be honest with you.
Why do you say, you know, whatever, we'll just embrace it?
Because what can you do? If I think back on my 10 years of applied nutrition, the amount of curveballs and obstacles that's been thrown at us, the world, Brexit, shipping crisis, ingredients volatility, laws by the government that's being implemented, it's not going to stop us or slow us down. We're going to navigate through it and just continue.
When you see the likes of, you know, Sir James Dyson this week, you know, he's sort of saying increasing inheritance taxes puts people off from having a family business, from starting a business, it can kill entrepreneurship. Do you go along with some of those sentiments that changes like that can put people off?
I've not seen that, to be honest with you. Like I said, I've been traveling. But what I can say is nothing should put anybody off being an entrepreneur. There's nothing. If you want to be an entrepreneur, you want to fulfill a dream, nothing should put you off. Nothing whatsoever. You've got to pursue it.
Really interesting. Tom Ryder, founder and chief executive of Applied Nutrition.
Thank you very much, John. Thank you.
You can hear a much longer version of that interview, including the story of how Tom Ryder came to be brought up by his grandparents, how much he owes them, particularly his Nana Sheila, on the Wake Up to Money podcast on BBC Sounds. Lucy Coates is with me, investment director and head of JM Finn's York office. Lucy, morning. We've had a bit of breaking news this morning on Boeing. After 7 weeks of strike action, the workers there have voted to accept a fresh pay offer from the plane maker. Is this a big moment?
It is much relief for this. So they've accepted a 38% increase over 4 years. And the management, Kelly Ortberg, who came into power or into position in August, he sort of also promised that the next plane that Boeing produces will be built at the Pacific Northwest. But this is very good news, especially now that it's shored up its balance sheet as well.
So good news from an investor perspective. Is that what you're talking about there? Because I see Michael O'Leary just in the Ryanair results yesterday when profits were falling at the huge European airline, mentioning once again those Boeing deliveries causing problems for his business.
Yeah, so he's had to sort of cut growth plans basically because of capacity constraints. Ryanair promised that they would sort of have 210 to 215 million sort of passengers, and it's going to be at the lower end, and simply because they've only had 172 aircraft delivered rather than 300 that they want from Boeing. But once production ramps up again, you know, those planes will come into the market, and Ryanair's numbers will rise, and they should hit their target of 300 million passengers in the medium term.
And Lucy, can I ask you, as we're hearing so much from Justin this morning, and will do, about goings-on in America, what are investors thinking? Because the markets, the levels of currency, the cost of borrowing for the US government have moved bits in recent days.
They have. There's, as we get closer, there's sort of less confidence that that Donald Trump will win. So yesterday we saw the US bond market, the yields sort of fell back a bit. Bitcoin came off a bit. Markets still remain volatile and the dollar's also weaker. And it's simply because Donald Trump, his policies of higher tariffs would feed into higher interest rates. And so that's why you're seeing the yields come back a bit.
And in the stock market, so the various shares that you'd be watching more closely depending on who wins.
A little bit. I mean, ultimately, equity markets just do what they do. Companies deliver. We all adapt and adjust. You know, you've just heard Tom Ryder speaking there with what other policies are there. But actually, interestingly, China, the stock market's doing well there again because, you know, if Trump comes to power, he's promising higher tariffs and we're expecting a big stimulus from China. But it would be bigger if Trump came to power.
Right, OK. There'll be plenty to get into once we have those results, whenever they come. Lucy, thank you. Lucy Coutts, Investment Director at JM Finn.
Sean, thank you. 6:30, sport from Carthy.
Morning, thank you very much. Two late goals in the 92nd and 97th minutes from substitute Harry Wilson snatched a 2-1 victory for Fulham against Brentford. The Fulham manager, Marco Silva, explains how he encouraged his players at half-time.
We have to keep pushing. It's going to come for us because the way we have been working, the way we play all the first half, the way we push back one team like Brentford because they have the quality, they defend well. And tonight we didn't give anything for them. Showed that we, the way we react, the moments that we lost the ball, we were really a top team in that moment. We react really strong and we believed always.
Clearly his speech worked. Well, tonight Manchester City are back in Champions League action against Sporting, but with the interesting twist that the Sporting boss, Ruben Amorim, has just two more games in charge of the Portuguese club before he becomes the manager of City's rivals, Manchester United. City's Portuguese midfielder, Bernardo Silva, knows Amorim well, having previously played alongside him at Benfica.
In terms of him going to Man United, well, I don't wish him very well, as you can imagine, because he's going to be my rival. But he deserves what he got. He deserves to be in one of the best clubs in the world right now, because the work that he did in the last years has been unbelievable, yeah.
Liverpool host Bayer Leverkusen tonight, with the Leverkusen manager Xabi Alonso keen to focus on the game rather than the emotion of his return to his former club. Celtic go into their match against RB Leipzig, having picked up 4 points from their 3 Champions League matches. You can keep up to date with all of tonight's European games with commentary and updates on 5 Live Sport. The Real Madrid manager Carlo Ancelotti has said football in Spain should have been suspended following the flash floods in the Valencia region. 6 top flight matches went ahead at the weekend. Real Madrid are due to host AC Milan tonight. To tennis, and the 3-time Grand Slam champion Aryna Sabalenka has reached the semi-finals of the season-ending WTA Tour Finals after a straight sets win over the Wimbledon finalist Jasmine Paolini. The victory puts Sabalenka one step closer to holding the year-end world number one ranking.
I mean, yeah, that's definitely one of the goals, and I've always been saying that for me it's about to finish the year as world number one, so I'll do everything I can to finish the year as world number one.
And Knight's Choice has won Australia's famous Melbourne Cup horse race, with the results going to a photo finish. It was Irish jockey Robbie Dolan's first ride in the event, and it was a second victory for New Zealand trailer Sheila Laxon.
Carthy, thank you. Let us look ahead now to tomorrow morning on Radio 4.
Life can change in an instant.
You are allowed to feel upset. You are allowed to feel angry. You are allowed to feel emotionally drained.
And set us on a new path.
But there does become a point where you just have to stop and move on. Because if you don't move on, you're going to miss so much.
Join me, Dr. Sian Williams, as I hear stories of pivotal moments and the transformations they inspire.
We helped her, but she helped us more. She has taught me that there always is a future.
Life-changing on BBC Sounds and Radio 4 starts tomorrow morning at 9.
The time is now 27 minutes to 7. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Justin Webb in Washington, Michelle Hussein in London, Alan Smith with the news.
The US presidential candidates Kamala Harris and Donald Trump have made their final appeals to American voters ahead of polls opening for millions in one of the tightest races in decades. Ms. Harris told her supporters they had a chance to turn the page on politics that had been driven by fear and division. Mr. Trump said he'd launch the most extraordinary economic boom the world had ever seen. The Polish authorities have warned that flammable packages placed on cargo flights earlier this year were possible practice runs by Russia's spy agency for attacks on transatlantic planes. One package caught fire in a warehouse in Birmingham in July, another on the ground in Germany, and two more were found in Poland. Russia has denied involvement. Workers at the US aircraft manufacturer Boeing have accepted a pay deal to end a seven-week strike. Under the agreement, some 33,000 workers in Washington state will receive a 38% pay rise during the next 4 years. A BBC investigation has found senior doctors are charging the NHS premium rates for overtime, with some being paid more than £200 an hour. NHS England said hospitals had to offer rates that were competitive with the private sector, while hospitals said covering for strike days and sickness had also been factors. Plans have been announced to extend the smoking ban to some outdoor spaces in England, including at playgrounds and near schools and hospitals. But the proposals won't include pub gardens. The bill, first proposed by the Conservatives, also includes plans to limit vaping and gradually phase out the sale of tobacco. Nearly 600 police officers were sacked and barred from returning to work in the year to March. Figures from the College of Policing show that's 50% more than the previous year. And two more cases of the new strain of Mpox have been detected in England. The UK Health Security Agency says the patients who are being treated in hospital in London are household contacts of an initial case detected last week. The agency says the risk to the public remains low.
Thank you. It is 25 to 7. Finally, the day has arrived. Polling day in the 2024 American presidential election. Jess Parker is our BBC correspondent here in Washington. Jess, set the scene for what happens today and, crucially, I suppose, when we might know what the...
Yeah, good morning. Well, I mean, the first votes have been cast in a place called Dixville Notch in New Hampshire. They have a tradition there of midnight voting, and CNN reporting a 3-3 tie in the tiny township. But I don't think we can read too much into that at this stage. But mostly voting tends to open local time in US states around 7 a.m. with some variants rolling east to west across America's time zones. As we've been reporting, millions of people, around 80 million, have voted already in casting early ballots, but millions more to go. And then from the evening, local time again, polls start closing, and the races could start being called by US networks in those less competitive states where the results pretty clear, where they think a lead can't be beaten by the other candidate. But of course, those swing states, they could take longer. There's the prospect, I guess, if it's really close, of recounts. Separately, of course, lots of speculation about what could happen with legal challenges. So it may not just be a long night coming up, but some long days too. And there's, of course, another big question is, if Trump is on course to lose, will he refuse to concede like he did last time?
Yeah, which we put to one of his key advisors later on in the programme. I just wonder, do you get the impression, is it fair to say, that the Democrats go into this day slightly more cheerfully than the Republicans?
I think there's definitely been a sense over the last 24 to 48 hours of a bit of momentum or hope building up around the Kamala Harris campaign. I mean, there was that Iowa poll that we've been talking about, which, you know, not one of the swing states, but this one pollster, but a respected pollster, put out a surprise that Kamala Harris was polling slightly ahead there. So I think there is a bit of optimism. But look, I mean, I think as well, both sides trying to talk up their momentum. I've been watching their final closing rallies. Just a few moments ago, Donald Trump was still going in Grand Rapids, Michigan, despite it being 1:30 in the morning. Covered a lot of things, their usual message, US in decline, decay, promising his own golden age, running against, he said, an evil system, still bringing up unevidenced claims that the other side is cheating, while Kamala Harris in Philadelphia, I mean, she had these performances from Lady Gaga and was walking around hand in hand with Oprah Winfrey on stage, and she's trying to project this sort of message of optimism and unity and freedom. So I think to the end you've seen this like more slightly professional, typical scripted politician from Kamala Harris, and then Trump, more spontaneous but a more erratic performer as well.
Jess Barker here in Washington. Thank you.
It is coming up to 20 to 7, and back here, a tobacco and vapes bill is going to be introduced at Westminster today, with the government acting on what Rishi Sunak had first put forward, that today's 15-year-olds and everyone born from 2009 onwards will never be able to legally buy cigarettes. Hugh Pym, our health editor, joins us. What in this bill goes further, Hugh, than the last government would have done?
Well, Labour are adopting that bill and just adding certain elements, but the crucial ones with smoking are to introduce a ban on some outdoor public spaces. There's obviously a ban at the moment on enclosed public spaces for smoking, but the idea is to make areas immediately outside schools and hospitals and in children's playgrounds areas where it won't be possible to smoke. That'll become illegal. There are already such plans outside hospitals in Scotland and Wales. This will apply to England. And in terms of vaping, the previous tobacco and vapes bill, which still because of the general election included a lot of measures to crack down on underage vaping, well, this bill will include an extra measure which will require retailers selling vapes and tobacco products to be licensed, and also there'll be on-the-spot fines of £200 for any retailer selling to anyone under the age of 18. So it does go further, but of course it doesn't include that measure that was talked about quite extensively a few weeks back to ban smoking in pub gardens, outside spaces in the hospitality area, after a bit of pushback from that industry.
Yeah, that's quite a significant change, isn't it? Because when it was first reported, the Prime Minister sounded really punchy about that idea. He was speaking in broad terms, but he didn't row back from the idea that smoking in pub gardens was going to be banned.
No, I think that that's absolutely right. It felt like a bit of a kite which was being flown just to see what the reaction would be. And a lot in the health world thought it was a very good idea, but the hospitality sector pushed back quite strongly. And I think it wasn't denied by government sources that the economic argument about not damaging the restaurant pub trade sort of came ahead of the health argument. So there may be continued debate over whether that is necessary. Going back to vaping, these measures will also allow a ban on vaping in these areas outside schools and hospitals, subject to consultation. And that will be an interesting one to see how that develops. The Independent Vape Trade Association has welcomed the bill, saying that it'll be better to have a licensing regime so that the responsible retailers can carry on their trade and others can be dealt with. But they've said there is a danger this will go a little bit too far with regulatory overkill, in their opinion, which may hamper the future of vaping as the UK's leading aid for quitting smoking for adults.
Hugh Pym, thank you.
It is 18 minutes to 7. Meeting the government's target of using clean energy by 2030 will be a huge challenge, but is achievable, according to a report commissioned by the Energy Secretary, Ed Miliband. Justin Rowlett, the BBC's climate editor, is on the line. Who's telling us this, Justin?
Well, Justin, this is from the National Energy System Operator, NESO. It's the public body that runs the UK electricity system day to day, and it also plans how it needs to look in the future. And I think this report was commissioned by Ed Miliband to address the criticism lots of people have made of this 2030 target. So economists, people within the electricity, within the Tory party, they've said this clean electricity target is either not possible or would be so expensive it would not be sensible. And as you say, the report says, look, clean sources can produce the power Britain needs, but the report acknowledges that it will, and I quote, push what is feasibly deliverable. So the backbone is going to be offshore wind, the report says. That will generate about half of UK electricity. It means offshore wind needs to be built at more than double the rate ever achieved before in the UK. That's going to be a real challenge. We're not doing that now. The cost of offshore wind has been rising. Onshore wind and solar will provide another kind of roughly a third. Again, that requires a big expansion. The report says these totals could be lower if new technologies, things like carbon capture and storage and hydrogen technologies, come online. And it also talks about maybe extending the life of at least one of the UK's ageing fleet of nuclear power stations. And I'm not finished yet. On top of that, there'll be, need to be a massive expansion in electricity storage. So think batteries, pumped hydro, that kind of thing. So it's a huge investment programme.
And a huge investment program, so a huge sum of money. Are they playing about the sums of money that would have to be spent?
Yeah, they're saying it will be expensive. The cost is reckoned to be about £40 billion a year. It will also require big reforms of the planning system to get the permissions needed for, wait for it, an estimated 1,000 kilometres of new power lines, think pylons, 5,000 kilometres of undersea cables, as well as all the new generation capacity that I've talked about. But most of the money, the report says, is going to come from the private sector, which is going to build that infrastructure. It means everyone in the industry, so the regulator, the power companies, the government, working together and working together quickly and efficiently. It'll also mean changes for consumers. There'll be, you know, an attempt to get us to respond to price signals more. So perhaps, you know, we'd be facing higher prices for peak demand, and maybe there'll be more rewards for us using electricity when supply is plentiful. It says prices will be more stable, costs, the price could fall, it says, and of course there will be a massive benefit for the planet, for the environment, because of course our electricity will be much lower carbon as a result.
Justin Rowland, thank you.
More on that after 7 o'clock, so we'll be hearing from the man running that independent advisory body. Let's turn to the papers now, and tuition fees on several front pages this morning. The Daily Mail says the increase in England is a U-turn by the government. The Telegraph casts it in the same way. The Times focuses on the education secretary saying that universities are going to have to improve, implement reforms in exchange for the higher fees, including more help for students from disadvantaged backgrounds. And the Guardian pointing out that while university vice chancellors welcomed this increase, privately, however, many are concerned it will not be enough to plug the gaps as they grapple with a drop in income from international students whose recruitment is down as a result of a clampdown on student visas. Home Office figures show 16% fewer visa applications were made between July and September than in the same period in 2023. This has resulted in dozens of universities reducing courses and cutting jobs to save money.
Here in America, the papers, not surprisingly, concentrating on the events of today. The New York Times saying a grim Trump and upbeat Harris end the race, hitting opposite notes. The moods and messages, the New York Times says, were more different than ever as the presidential rivals made one last scramble through battleground states, their ambitions riding heavily on one of those states. And that state is Pennsylvania, where we're reporting from later on in the program, where, of course, we've already been. So Trump and Harris closing out their campaigns on Monday. New York Times says, in stop after stop, the presidential rivals essentially offering two competing versions of reality in the final hours before election day. And the Wall Street Journal, among the many papers here, suggesting an hour-by-hour guide to election night, but also, as they say in brackets, don't hold us to it, because, of course, one of the things that is uncertain is exactly when any of the results will actually be called.
Speaking of hour-by-hour, how are you in the middle of the night doing the Today
so far,
programme from
good,
the
actually.
East Coast?
Yeah.
So far, okay. Courage. Till the end, till 9 o'clock our time. Let's turn back to parliamentary events here, because the announcement of tuition fees rising in England has given the House of Commons Speaker, Sir Lindsay Hoyle, further evidence of something he profoundly objects to, a measure being reported by journalists before it is announced to Parliament. He now wants a full leak inquiry, as our parliamentary correspondent Sean Curran reports.
Last week, an angry Commons speaker criticised Rachel Reeves for telling journalists about some of her budget plans before the policies were presented to MPs. Now, Sir Lindsay Hoyle is hardly the first speaker to complain about announcements being made outside the House of Commons. It's been a feature of political and parliamentary life for decades. But whereas in the 1980s the Speaker might make two or three statements a year protesting about the practice, for Sir Lindsay, it's becoming a weekly event.
Before I call the Education Secretary to make a statement, I note the reports about the possible increase in higher education tuition fee starts appearing in the media early this afternoon.
As the Education Secretary looked on, the Speaker said it would be a great discourtesy to the House if the media reports were based on an unauthorised leak. Bridget Phillipson had come to the Commons to make a statement about the decision to increase university tuition fees in England for the first time in 8 years.
Can I begin by saying I wish to express my deep regret that the content of the statement that I'm about to give appeared in the media earlier this afternoon.
She said she'd always intended to make the announcement to MPs first. Sir Lindsay stressed he wanted a full leak inquiry.
That everybody will be brought in, questioned, and you will then update us with a full inquiry. That's what I really want.
Mr. Speaker, I can give you that undertaking and I will speak to officials on the matter as you request.
The Speaker seemed happy with that, and the Education Secretary went on to confirm that from next year, university tuition fees in England will go up in line with inflation by £285 to £9,535. Bridget Phillipson said she wanted to reassure students who were already at university.
When you start repaying your loan, you will not see higher monthly repayments as a result of these changes to fee and maintenance loans. That's because student loans are not like consumer loans. Monthly repayments depend on earnings, not simply the amount borrowed or interest rates. And at the end of any loan term, any outstanding loan balance, including interest built up, will be written off. Increasing the fee cap has not been an easy decision. But I want to be crystal clear that this will not cost graduates more each month as they start to repay their loans.
But the new Conservative Shadow Education Secretary, Laura Trott, complained that students hadn't had time to prepare for the rise, and she wanted to know why the change hadn't been announced in the budget.
Why were Labour not upfront about this in their manifesto? Yeah, Madam Deputy Speaker, in June 2023, the title of an article written by the now Secretary of State proclaimed, "Graduates, you will pay less under a Labour government." Well, Madam Deputy Speaker, it turns out you will pay more. More broken promises.
Yeah, yeah.
Bridget Phillipson brushed that aside as faux outrage. For the Liberal Democrats, Ian Solum said the current system for funding universities was broken. He complained that the Conservatives had abolished maintenance grants, which didn't have to be paid back. And he said other changes meant today's students would be paying more and for longer than older graduates.
The first priority must be to fully reform and fix the damage that those changes made and create a fair system for all students. That has to be the best way forward, not simply putting up fees without those much wider reforms.
Ian Solum only became an MP this year. The Education Secretary pointed out, or as she put it, gently observed, that the Liberal Democrats had form on this topic. When he was Labour leader, Jeremy Corbyn promised to scrap university tuition fees. Now an independent MP, he argued that charging more would only drive people away from university education.
Universities should not be dependent just on student income to survive. Shouldn't we be moving in the direction of lowering or indeed removing fees altogether to make higher and further education open genuinely to all in our society?
Bridget Phillipson repeated that increasing the fees had been a difficult but necessary decision. But she agreed that universities could do more to make sure they had a wide source of income.
Sean Curran reporting on yesterday in Parliament. It brings us to 8 minutes to seven. We are hearing during the course of the morning from the swing states of North Carolina and Pennsylvania. We should touch base, though, first with two others. Arizona in the so-called Sun Belt and Michigan up in the northern Rust Belt, or former Rust Belt. Emma Vardy is in Arizona, Ione Wells in Michigan, where Donald Trump has been holding his final rally of the campaign. And we started when we talked with the reception that there was for him.
Well, certainly enthusiasm. People were there hours and hours before his final rally, which didn't start until very, very late at night. And most people in the queue were raising issues like immigration in particular. I heard the same messages again and again, people saying they want Donald Trump to close the border, that they want to clamp down on what they see as, in their words, an influx of immigration. And they also feel like they are not better off now than they were 4 years ago, which is a trope that he has played played on heavily in a lot of his rallies. There were also hints at what I think could be described as people already sort of questioning the electoral integrity. Donald Trump has used these last couple of days of his campaign to, without any evidence, claim that the opposition are cheating and that there may be electoral fraud. And I think a lot of his supporters seem to be sort of on board with that message, a hint there that they may not accept the result unless it is a win for Donald Trump.
What are the messages from the Trump camp in Arizona, Emma?
I think actually the Trump campaign are feeling quite confident in Arizona, because although it's a really tightly contested race, it's really close in the swing states, we know that. Here, the polls have indicated a small lead for Donald Trump since about mid-September, and he's kind of held on to that, and in some other places, the race has changed hands a few times. So I think inside the Trump campaign, they're feeling that they have Arizona in the bag, but that is by no means certain. We know, of course, from history, the polls are not the full story. When you talk to people on the streets here, there is this confidence from some diehards, you know, their team's going to win, and you hear that a lot. But underneath that, there are a lot of people who are really nervous about the result here, really, really apprehensive. One person told me that her hands were shaking when she filled out her ballot. So we really are on the brink of something here that I think is making a lot of people very nervous.
We've talked a lot, Ione, about Michigan during the course of the last few months, and specifically about Gaza and the potential impact of Gaza on some Muslim voters in Michigan, and possibly that losing it for Kamala Harris. Has that in the final days for the Harris campaign been an issue they've tried to address?
It is. I think it was really significant, actually. I was at Kamala Harris's final rally in Michigan, and one of her first statements in that rally speech was that she would do everything she could to end the war in Gaza. I think that was a really deliberate message to land here in Michigan, even if she didn't really spell out what that would look like, because of the backlash that she and the Democrats more widely have faced here. I think we've got to remember it is a very painful moment for lots of Lebanese and Palestinian families here in Michigan who have had families affected by the war. They are furious about American taxes going towards Israel in particular. I spoke to a lot of Arab Americans when I was in Dearborn, which is the largest Arab American city in the US. It was a place where Donald Trump campaigned on Friday. Unthinkable that he would have campaigned there years ago, given some of his rhetoric in the past about Muslims, given the so-called Muslim ban that he signed when he was president. But he has capitalized on the fact that there is this anger at the Democrats and at Joe Biden's administration's handling of the war in the Middle East. I spoke to some people there in Dearborn who've got mixed reactions, some saying that they will vote for a third party candidate, somebody like the Greens' Jill Stein, some that they might not vote at all for a presidential candidate, and some switching to Donald Trump. So it is certainly a challenge for Kamala Harris and her campaign, but I think that message she tried to land is a very deliberately targeted one, and one she will hope will cut through in these final days.
And of course, if she were to do well in Arizona, Emma, it would be specifically, one assumes, because abortion is an issue that is actually on the ballot.
It is. Arizona's one of 10 states where voters are also being asked to decide, should women have a right to abortion, which is effectively put into the state's laws. Now, despite being behind Trump in the polls here, or appearing to be, Kamala Harris is hoping that perhaps the numbers aren't telling you everything, that she is counting on this sort of quiet female vote. Perhaps women aren't even being public about, you know, which way they're going on this. But the fact that abortion is something people are being asked to vote on may bring out women in greater numbers, and that could benefit Kamala Harris and the Democrats.
Emma Vardy in Arizona, Ione Wells in Michigan. Thank you both.
I'm Danny Robbins, and things are starting to get even stranger in our trilogy of uncanny specials.
This was so beyond the realm of anything that I had ever experienced.
Episode 1 features the comedian and writer Stuart Lee.
Crossing the road walked a huge black dog. It turned to stare at him with eyes like saucers.
And then we take our first steps into a brand new investigation at Meadow Cottage.
In the corner, this thing just started laughing. It was eerie.
Listen to Uncanny on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Let's get the weather now, which is with Simon King.
Michelle, thanks so much indeed. The weather is stuck in a rut at the moment. We've got some settled weather once again, and it means that for most of us it's going to be another grey and overcast day. Very little in the way of any brightness. But there will be some today, more so actually than the last couple of days, across parts of northern Scotland, northern and east Wales. But let's start off in southwest, southeast and eastern England, where we've got some mist and some fog patches, particularly over the hills of southwest England this morning. The visibilities should improve gradually over the next few hours. It will stay pretty grey and overcast for most of the day, and temperatures getting to about 13 to 16 degrees. For Wales and the Midlands, a bit of mist and some fog patches again, especially over the hills. Much of this will eventually clear away, and as I said, for most it's going to be pretty grey and overcast. However, there will be some brighter skies. The sun trying to break through that cloud across north and east Wales today, so a bit brighter here later on, and temperatures of 13 or 14 Celsius. Now, across northwest and northeast England, again, some mist and some hill fog. That's going to clear away. And once again, lots of cloud, but a few bits of brightness coming through later on. Highs of about 12 or 13 Celsius. Across Northern Ireland, central and southern Scotland, the mist will clear away this morning. Pretty grey and overcast with highs of 12 or 13. And for northern Scotland, a bit of drizzle early on this morning, actually. That's going to clear away. And for northern Scotland, actually, the best place to get some sunshine today. So a bright afternoon to come with highs of 9 to 12 degrees. But as we go through tonight, lots of cloud once again, mist and fog into Wednesday morning.
Simon, thank you. You are listening to Today on BBC Radio 4. Michelle Hussain in London, Justin Webb in Washington, D.C.
It's 7 o'clock on Tuesday, the 5th of November. The headlines this morning: millions of American voters are preparing to go to the polls in one of the closest and most bitterly contested presidential races in living memory. A BBC investigation has found that senior doctors in the NHS are making more than £200,000 a year, in some cases, in overtime because of pressure to cut waiting lists. We've asked the Health Secretary what he thinks of that.
No, I don't think these kinds of rates are acceptable. Every penny that goes into the NHS needs to be money that is well spent.
And in that interview, Wes Reaching's also been talking about why a ban on smoking in pub gardens floated over the summer is not in the government's new tobacco and vapes bill.
And here in Washington, as polling day gets underway across America, we will hear from senior Democrats and Trump advisers as well.
And I see a campaign that in a very short period of time made this an extremely competitive race, with vote probably trending a little towards her here in the closing hours of the election.
The vast majority of people have not gone over the fact that inflation has wiped out their savings. They haven't gone over the fact that inflation has caused them to max out their credit cards. They haven't gone over the fact that, you know, when they go grocery shopping, they have to buy less food.
The BBC News is read this morning by Alan Smith.
The candidates in the US presidential election have made their final pitches to voters, with millions expected to head to the polls in the coming hours. The outcome is predicted to be tight and is likely to be decided by seven swing states, with opinion polling suggesting no clear victor. Donald Trump, the Republican candidate, made Michigan his final stop, where he pledged to lead the US to new heights of glory. He was boosted by an endorsement from the influential podcaster Joe Rogan. Our correspondent Ione Wells sent this report from Michigan.
When I spoke to Donald Trump supporters in the queue for his final rally, the same themes came up again and again. Close the borders, improve the economy. It's no surprise when speaking to his fans that he chose to focus on immigration and the economy in his closing pitch.
Your paychecks will be higher, your streets will be safer and cleaner, your communities will be richer, and your future will be brighter than ever before. This will be the golden age of America.
He also used the final day of his campaign to repeat unfounded claims that his opponents were cheating. His critics say he's laying the ground to challenge the result if he loses. His last rally in Michigan was in a city that was once a Republican stronghold, but turned Democrat in 2020. In other parts of the state that used to be Democrats, voters have told me they're switching to Donald Trump because they back his immigration and economic policies.
Kamala Harris focused her final effort in Philadelphia in Pennsylvania, saying her campaign appealed to the aspirations and dreams of the American people. Our correspondent Tom Bateman was watching.
Welcome the next president of these United States, Kamala Harris!
Well, the crowd is many, many thousands strong.
at this final push by the Harris campaign to get its vote out here in perhaps the most critical of swing states. And their candidate, hand in hand with Oprah Winfrey, is making her way to the stage.
America is ready for a fresh start, ready for a new way forward where we see our fellow American not as an enemy, but as a neighbor. And we are ready for a president who knows that the true measure of a leader is not based on who you beat down, but based on who you lift up.
The speech was focused on optimism and hope. The Harris campaign thinks that creates a clear counterpoint to what they assert are the shadowy, foreboding messages of her rival. In reality, both campaigns have dwelt on claims of dystopian prospects if they lose, while Kamala Harris has outperformed Joe Biden's poll ratings before the Democrats ousted him as their candidate. She hasn't broken the deadlock with Donald Trump right up to election day.
Our North America editor Sarah Smith says many in the US are nervous about the coming days.
There's a much greater air of uncertainty around today's vote than there usually is on election day, with polls suggesting that it is an exceptionally tight race. No one knows who's likely to emerge the winner. But that is not the only question surrounding the process. We don't know when a result will be declared, as it could take days to get a final vote count from some of the key battleground states like Pennsylvania. And there's also trepidation about how people might react to the result. The National Guard's on standby in Washington State, Oregon and Nevada in case of civil unrest. And security barriers have been erected outside the White House and other sites around the Capitol. Voters say they are exhausted by this tumultuous campaign and want it to be over, but are also apprehensive about what may happen next. Tensions running high in this deeply divided nation, which is about to make a critical decision.
The Polish authorities have warned that incendiary packages placed on cargo flights earlier this year were possible practice runs by Russia's spy agency for attacks on transatlantic planes. One package caught fire in a warehouse in Birmingham in July, another on the ground in Germany, and two more were found in Poland. Russia has denied involvement. Here's our security correspondent Frank Gardner.
More details are now emerging about a series of arson attacks that Western intelligence officials suspect were part of an orchestrated campaign by Russia's military intelligence agency, the GRU. The authorities in Poland now believe this was a practice run for future devices to be placed on planes bound for the US and Canada. Packages containing erotic gadgets and massage pillows appear to have been used as cover to smuggle highly dangerous incendiary devices onto cargo routes destined for Western Europe. One ignited at a DHL warehouse outside Birmingham, another in Leipzig in Germany, a third in Warsaw, and a fourth was intercepted by the Polish authorities.
Tens of thousands of workers at Boeing in the US have voted to accept a deal to end a 7-week walkout. More than half backed the agreement, which will see them receive a 38% pay rise during the next 4 years. Our business correspondent Theo Leggett reports.
33,000 Boeing employees will now return to work following a strike that analysts believe has cost the company and its suppliers more than $8 billion. It paralyzed production of two of the company's best-selling aircraft, the 737 MAX and the 777. For the workforce in Washington state, this is a remarkable victory. The deal they've approved is significantly better than Boeing's original offer. But the row has exposed long-standing resentments between management and staff on the factory floor.
A BBC investigation has found senior doctors are charging the NHS premium rates for overtime, with some making more than £200,000 extra every year for the additional work. That's almost double the average pay for a full-time consultant in England. Here's our health correspondent, Nick Triggle.
The government has made tackling the hospital backlog a priority, promising to put on extra clinics at weekends and evenings in England. But the BBC investigation found the NHS is having to pay the most senior doctors significant sums to do additional work. Rates exceeding £200 an hour, more than four times normal pay, are being charged. The British Medical Association defended the rates, saying staffing shortages were to blame. Hospitals said covering strikes and sickness absence were also factors, and they were trying to bear down on the highest rates of pay.
The government has announced plans to extend the smoking ban in enclosed public places in England to outdoor areas close to schools, hospitals and children's playgrounds. But ministers have decided not to outlaw smoking in pub gardens. Our health editor Hugh Pym reports.
Plans for a smoking ban were put forward by the last government to gradually raise the legal age for tobacco so that anyone aged 15 or under now could never be sold cigarettes during their lifetime. There were also proposals to crack down on underage vaping. Now Labour are taking forward the ideas with new measures, including an extension of the current smoking ban to some outdoor spaces, such as children's playgrounds and areas near schools and hospitals, and a vaping ban in some of these spaces. There'll also be a licensing scheme for retailers, with on-the-spot fines of £200.
The six-time Olympic cycling champion Sir Chris Hoy says he wants young men to be screened for prostate cancer to try to save millions of lives. His first in-depth interview since making his terminal diagnosis public, Sir Chris, who's 48, said he hoped there would be a surge of people coming forward for testing. He wants those with a family history of prostate cancer to be screened.
It's logical to me that why would you not just get the test a little bit earlier, catch it before you need to have any major treatment? So it's, to me, it seems a no-brainer. Why would they not allow more men to just go in and get a blood test? Maybe people seeing this or hearing about my story and then just by them asking their GP will create enough of a surge of interest that the people that make decisions will go, do you know what, we need to address this.
That was Sir Chris Hoy.
Helen, thank you. 9 minutes past seven is the time. It is over, at least the campaign is. Polling day is dawning here in America. I've been speaking to voters in the swing states of Pennsylvania and North Carolina. Pennsylvania, which Kamala Harris must win, and North Carolina, which Donald Trump must win. First, to Reading, Pennsylvania.
Me and my wife, we're all Democrats. We're voting Republican. We just can't do it anymore. I voted for Trump in 2016, 2020, and this is my third time. I just had enough. I mean, the prices are outrageous. You just can't live anymore. I can't even retire. It's time for me to have a life of leisure now, and I can't do it. I can't afford it. I didn't like Biden. I didn't like Kamala, or whatever, however you say it. I don't really care for them.
But why not? What is it about them that's moved them from you?
I don't really think we're ready for a woman president. Okay? That's about it.
I, for one, don't really get along with the polls so much. What really matters to me is what's going to happen. When all the votes are tallied and everything is said and done, and I'm claiming it's going to be Kamala, as you can see with my shirt, but the polls don't always get it with me because everybody doesn't give their truthful opinion at that time.
Some of the thoughts of voters as the campaign came to a close, but will they get a result tonight in what some are already dubbing the litigation election? There are already arguments about ballots that should or should not be counted. Are they signed properly? Have they been placed in the right envelope, etc.? Ben Ginsberg is one of the leading authorities on election law in America. He worked on George W. Bush's election victory in the year 2000, which, of course, was decided in the end by the Supreme Court. So when does he think an election result might become clear?
Well, my head and my gut tell me that if it's a close election, I would say Friday or Saturday for news organizations being comfortable enough to make a call, if it's close.
Can we focus on one state, Pennsylvania, which everyone believes might be the state that decides it and the state that is also painfully, painfully close? In Pennsylvania, we've already seen some court cases, haven't we, over who has the right to vote and which ballots should be counted and which shouldn't. What would you expect specifically in Pennsylvania?
We have seen court cases in Pennsylvania, but we've seen numerous court cases in all seven of the battleground states. There are complaints about how strictly to read state laws. There are suits involving whether illegal voters are on the rolls and casting ballots. There are suits about whether the voting machines are tabulating accurately. Pennsylvania does have one unique feature, and that is the way people vote by mail. In Pennsylvania, mail ballots come in secrecy envelopes, and there is a question over whether people who forget to use the secrecy envelope should have their ballots counted.
How likely do you think it is in Pennsylvania or indeed in other states that all of what you've just described actually holds up a result?
Remember that the results that you get immediately following the election are projections by media organizations and campaigns. If there is a wide margin between the candidates, then news organizations will feel comfortable making calls on who won. If the results are narrow, with 70% or so of the votes in, then it'll take some time.
You were working for George W. Bush back in the year 2000, which was, of course, eventually settled by the Supreme Court. Can you see it going the same way?
Well, it's an historical anomaly if a race ends up with a 537-vote margin in an outcome determinative state. That is the roulette wheels of the election turning in a very unpredictable fashion. So I think that historically it's quite unlikely that there will be one state that close that determines an election. And generally, a close election is like what happened in 2020, which is when there were a number of states that were 10,000 or more votes with the margins. And that's a pretty big margin to actually turn around in a recount because the voting machines are simply too accurate.
Mm. And it's also, of course, the case, isn't it, that swing states tend, don't they, to swing in the same direction, as it were. So we might be talking about a very close election, but a one that's nonetheless decisive.
Well, I think that's true. Also, generally speaking, when seven states are being called by all the pollsters as close as they are, that's not the way it turns out. But we'll see.
Ben Ginsburg, thank you very much for talking to us.
And if you are watching or listening to the results coming in tonight, just worth saying the polls close in the swing state of Georgia at midnight UK time, half an hour later and in North Carolina. And there is a suggestion this morning that those states might be called by the networks by the time we go on air with the program tomorrow morning. That's because they've improved the vote counting procedures in both of them. And if Donald Trump loses either of those, he might be in real trouble. Though if he wins, it doesn't really necessarily tell us much more about the race. Anyway, the whole of it and all the news of the election on the live news stream on BBC Sounds. It's from 10 o'clock tonight. Roz Atkins and Nuala McGovern are going to be here throughout the night. And America Decides is the name of the program.
And at 16 minutes past seven, let us turn to Sean Farrington, because the merger between the mobile networks Vodafone and Three has taken a big step towards being completed. Sean?
It's interesting one, this. If it went ahead, could create the UK's biggest mobile network. The regulator, the Competition and Markets Authority, said just in September the deal would weaken competition, lead to higher prices for millions of mobile users. But this morning it's saying the deal can go ahead if certain investment commitments are agreed to over the next 8 years and customers are protected from some higher prices and worse product offerings for 3 years. Stuart McIntosh is chairing the inquiry into the merger for the regulator. Morning to you.
Good morning, Sean.
Has the approach of the regulator changed and your view on this deal since the government said to the CMA you need to prioritise growth more?
I wouldn't say it's changed. I mean, the legal framework governing the assessment of mergers is one which is very much concerned with the impact of mergers on competition and customers. And that's how we have looked at this particular case. However, I think it's probably fair to say that the CMA's general position is that strong competition promotes innovation, investment and growth. And if we look at the Vodafone and Three case, were we to conclude that the merger should be cleared on competition grounds, that in part would be because of the positive impact of the legally binding commitment on network investment. Hmm. And it's also likely to be positive, therefore, for growth.
Would you expect, if you, as part of this deal, if it all gets signed, that customers protected for 3 years, so therefore you can expect prices to be going up after 3 years' time?
No, I don't think that's the case. I mean, I think you did articulate the case at the beginning of your introduction very well, but we anticipate in the longer term that the significant commitment to upgrade the merged company's network over the next 10 years or so will ultimately create a competitive environment which will maintain the sort of competition that we've seen in mobile in recent years, we are concerned about the impact in the shorter term, because it takes time for those investments to have an effect on the competition between the companies. So I think what we have done is try to make sure that in the short term, both consumers and also wholesale customers of the mobile network operators will be protected. But we would anticipate that by the time we get to the end of that shorter period, that 3 years, if that's what it works out to be,
what happens in
competition will be strong.
Sorry to interrupt you. What happens in those 3 years, just briefly, if prices go up higher than you think they should?
Well, what we're doing is, with regard to prices, we're looking at this at the moment, and the document we have produced today is in the form of consultation on what we might do on prices. But we would be looking in respect of the merged company to cap an array of specific services, which would reflect their popularity with customers, the extent to which their value for money, and also that they would cover a number of data allowances. Right. So the prices of those tariffs would actually not be able to increase during that three-year period.
Stuart McIntosh, Chair of the Regulator's Inquiry into the Vodafone 3 merger. Thank you very much.
Sean, thank you. 19 minutes past seven. I'll never forget the words, "It's incurable," Sir Chris Hoy has said in a BBC interview, recorded not long after he revealed his cancer diagnosis is terminal. He does have a family history of prostate cancer, and he thinks men with a similar history in their family should be able to get a test at a younger age than the current 50. He spoke to Sally Newton from BBC Breakfast.
It's been the toughest year of our lives so far by some stretch. September 2023, I got the news that I had a terminal illness. So I've got stage 4 prostate cancer, completely out of the blue. No symptoms, no warnings, nothing. All I had was a pain in my shoulder and a bit of pain in my ribs. You know, I'm 48 years of age now, still lifting weights in the gym, still exercising hard. I just thought it was aches and pains. But this ache and pain didn't go away. And eventually I was, they suggested go for a scan. I assumed it was going to be tendonitis or something, you know, and it was just going to be lay off weights or lay off cycling for a wee while and get some treatment and it'll be fine. When the scan result came back, it was a tumour. It was the biggest shock of my life. I remember the feeling of just absolute horror and shock. And from then, you know, appointments and seeing different doctors and different hospitals. You were in this world where you felt like you were just existing. You weren't living. It was just like a living nightmare. I'll never forget the words, you know, it's incurable, but it's manageable. I think it's only when you're in really difficult situations you find out what you're made of and what you can deal with. And it puts into perspective riding bikes, you know, for a living. You'd sort of realise, God, that was just a bit of fun, really, you know.
You must recognise on some level that your years of training and practice and getting a hold of your emotions must now be helping you in some way. Do you think so?
Definitely, definitely. The stakes are much higher now. It felt like life and death in the moment when you're battling it out for an Olympic gold medal, but the stakes have changed dramatically and it is life and death. But I guess the principle is the same. It's about focusing on what you have control over and not worrying about the stuff that you can't control.
We're used to you being physically capable of anything, but even you found chemotherapy incredibly hard.
It was one of the biggest challenges I've ever faced and gone through. And it's walking into a cancer ward, seeing really ill people around you and just feeling like you're looking into the future. It's not a pleasant experience. They put like it's minus 27 Celsius mittens and socks on and an ice cap as well. The hands and feet is to stop you losing the sense of touch. For your head, it's to prevent hair loss or to minimise hair loss. I've not got much hair anyway. I wasn't fussed if I lost it. You know, I thought that's a small price to pay. But my son, you know, Callum was quite worried about what might happen. You know, are you going to lose your hair? So for him, I thought, well, this is something I want to do and it's important to do. But that was the biggest pain. That was the biggest challenge. It was excruciating. It's like torture, basically. It seems horrendous when you look, you think, oh, this is 2 more hours, I can't cope. Don't do it for 2 hours, do it for 1 minute. The strategy was just take it one step at a time. Just watch that seconds hand go around the clock. If you can do 1 more minute, that's all you need to do. And then when it gets round to the end of the minute, you do it again. You know, looking back now, my grandpa died from prostate cancer. My dad has had it, has been treated for it. So it is a genetic thing. It is in the family. But it can happen to anybody. you know, and it's not necessarily for old men, you know, and one in eight men will have prostate cancer in their life at some point, but if you've got family history of it, like I have, if you're over the age of 45, go and ask your doctor.
Do you think that the screening system for men should be different?
I believe that the screening for men with a strong family history of prostate cancer, it should be a lot younger. It's logical to me that why would you not just get the test a little bit earlier, catch it before you need to have any major treatment? To me, it seems a no-brainer. You know, why would they not reduce the age, bring the age down, allow more men to just go in and get a blood test?
Is that something you think you might be able to change?
I hope so. Maybe people hearing about my story and then just by them asking their GP will create enough of a surge of interest that the people that make decisions will go, do you know what, we need to address this. And it, in the long term, this will actually, even from a logistical point of view, it will save potentially millions of lives in the long term. And why wouldn't you? You know, why wouldn't you? When people talk about battles with cancer, for me, the biggest battle is between your ears. It's the mental struggle. When you hear terminal illness, terminal cancer, you just have this image in your head of what it's going to be like. And everybody's different, and not everybody is given the time that I've been given. You know, and that's why I feel lucky. You know, we genuinely feel lucky, as crazy as that might sound, because we've got the time. I'm not delusional. I know what the end result will be, but that's not changed. You know, nobody lives forever. That thing that you've always planned to do one day, why not do it today?
Sir Chris Hoy, I've been asking Wes Streeting, the Health Secretary, about his call for earlier testing. More on prostate cancer at 8:30. And the full interview, Sir Chris Hoy, Finding Hope, will be on BBC One at 8 o'clock tonight. His book, which is out later this week, is called All That Matters.
7:25 is the time. Barcelona is the latest part of Spain to be hit by flooding. People told there to avoid normally dry gorges or canals and highways. Air traffic control, commuter rail services all affected. And in and around Valencia, where flooding last week killed more than 200 people, dozens of others are still missing. Our correspondent Bethany Bell is there.
I'm in a park near the Turia River in Valencia, in front of an ever-growing mound of debris. Bulldozers and pickup trucks are bringing the contents of people's homes. Mud-stained mattresses, fridges, ovens, all destroyed, ruined in the mud and water.
There was water in houses. People don't have where to stay.
Close by, I met Kautar, a student, covered in mud. She's one of thousands of volunteers helping to clean up people's homes. She told me it's difficult work.
It's so sad, horrible. Like, you see people crying, people lost their homes, some people died. Family.
Yeah.
They need some help because it's not normal to wake up and find that your neighbors are dead.
Thousands of soldiers, police and emergency workers are here as part of what Spain's Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez has called the biggest peacetime deployment in his country's history. Jorge is from the Spanish Marines.
The catastrophe is big.
What are you doing?
Only cleaner, 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 cleaner.
Businesses have been hit hard too. Bus Motor, a small company which sells cleaning products online, has its warehouse in Picanha, one of the worst affected areas close to Valencia. Its press officer, Diego Navarro Rodriguez, says they've lost almost all their stock.
First, we need to get the mud out of the warehouse. From there, see how we can recover and how the central Spanish government and aid agencies are responding. At the moment, nothing much is getting through.
It will take weeks, if not months, before the extent of the damage is clear. Diego, another volunteer, says he's been helping in Paiporta, where dozens of people died.
People that live there are very grateful that we go help them. They need help, our help. So they are very grateful, yeah. In fact, we had one woman and she was crying and very helpful, telling us that we did a very great job.
That report from Bethany Bell in Valencia. Time now for the sport, which is with Cathy.
Morning, thank you very much. Fulham snatched victory away from Brentford with two late goals from substitute Harry Wilson. Wilson only came onto the pitch with 8 minutes of the game remaining, but he scored twice to give Fulham a 2-1 win. Manchester City face Sporting in the Champions League tonight with a rather interesting twist that the Sporting boss, Ruben Amorim, has just two more games in charge of the Portuguese club before he becomes the manager of City's rivals, Manchester United. Liverpool host Bayer Leverkusen and Celtic have 4 points from three Champions League games ahead of their match against RB Leipzig later. On to tennis, and the three-time Grand Slam champion Aryna Sabalenka has reached the semi-finals of the season-ending WTA Tour Finals after a straight sets win over the Wimbledon finalist Jasmine Paolini. That eliminates Elena Rybakina from the tournament in Saudi Arabia. The BBC sports correspondent Laura Scott has been in Riyadh and joins me. Laura, this is the first major professional women's sports event to be held in Saudi Arabia. Clearly, there was concern and criticism about hosting it there. What has been the players' reaction once they arrived in Riyadh?
Well, I'd say, Cathy, that the players were all very positive about the facilities there. And with Saudi Arabia now no stranger to hosting top-level sport, no expense had been spared on the presentation side of things. There was a beauty salon on site. They each had their own dressing room. There was even a mental health office at the university where it's being held. And I'd say the players appeared as though they felt free to answer questions on the subject of human rights. I asked all the top eight singles player the same questions about whether they had reservations or concerns about playing in the kingdom, given the human rights record there, specifically around women's rights and the LGBTQ plus community. And there was a mix of reaction. The player who spoke most extensively on this was the world number three, Coco Gauff, who said she was very concerned, as was her father. But she said that growing up black in America meant she felt that to bring about change, you have to start little by little.
Very aware that we're not going to come here and just change everything, but it's a nuanced kind of conversation. And I think knowing from the past and what my grandmother in integrating her school, people aren't going to like it, but obviously in the long run, I think it could be better for everybody.
Yeah, Coco Gauff always speaks very well, particularly given the background that she has as well. How, though, has the event been received in Riyadh itself, particularly as a first major women's sports event there?
Well, I think the authorities there are really hopeful that this can bring about lasting change in terms of inspiring the next generation of Saudi women and girls to play tennis. We spoke to some girls who are very keen on the sport who said it was life-changing to see their idols in their country. But of course, when you talk about reception, you look at the crowds, and there have been some very low crowd sizes. The capacity there is 4,200. There were only around a few hundred there on Sunday. That is the start of the working week in Saudi Arabia. But of course, it's not a good look for such a prestigious event as the year-end finals. And the WTA had initially planned to give us daily attendance figures, and they scrapped that plan, so we won't actually get that until an overall figure at the end. In anticipation of seeing empty seats, I did ask them what they would say in defence of their decision to bring it to a country that might not have an appetite for tennis at this stage. And they said that they have been pleased with the ticket sales. They're optimistic, but they did say that there would be learnings from this first finals of a three-year deal.
And briefly, just how much pressure is the WTA under for taking, as you've mentioned, a prestigious event to Saudi Arabia?
They're under a lot of pressure. They've had former legends like Martina Navratilova and Chris Evert urging them not to take it to Saudi Arabia, saying that to do so would be incompatible with the principles of women's tennis. They are, you know, adamant that that this can be a force for good, that the players haven't just gone to Riyadh to be paid record prize money of £12 million and that they won't just then pack up and leave, that they can bring about lasting change. But I think the critics will take some convincing that prize money hasn't come at the expense of principles.
Yeah, and it is a three-year deal, isn't it? Laura Scott, thank you very much. Just to mention one other tennis line for you, the British number two, Cam Norrie, has won his first ATP Tour match since July, beating Roberto Caballes Baena in Metz.
Thank you so much, Cathy. Now, on the day that America votes, here's how you can keep up to date with the US election.
America Decides.
On BBC Radio 4.
I'm Ros Atkins.
And I'm Nuala McGovern.
And as America chooses its next president, join us for an eventful election night, live from Washington.
We'll bring you all the breaking news and in-depth reporting from correspondents across the US as the results come in.
Analyzing the stories as they happen in this pivotal US presidential election.
America Decides.
throughout tonight from 10.
On Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
The weather, largely cloudy, some patchy mist and fog to start today. And I should tell you, in Washington today, it's going to be 25 degrees.
Enjoy. Coming up before 8 o'clock, we are going to be hearing from the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, on why the government has decided not to go ahead with banning smoking in pub gardens. But now a summary of the news from Alan Smith.
One of the most closely fought presidential election campaigns in US history is drawing to a close, with Donald Trump and Kamala Harris making their final pitch to voters. Tens of millions of early ballots have already been cast. Ms. Harris told supporters in Philadelphia, in Pennsylvania, the election was an opportunity to turn the page on politics driven by fear and division. In Michigan, Mr. Trump promised to deliver the biggest political victory in American history. Opinion polls suggest the vote is too close to call. The Polish authorities have warned that explosive packages placed on cargo flights earlier this year were possible practice runs by Russia's spy agency for attacks on transatlantic planes. One package caught fire in a warehouse in Birmingham in July, another on the ground in Germany, and two more were found in Poland. Russia has denied involvement. Workers at the US aircraft manufacturer Boeing have accepted a pay deal to end a seven-week strike which paralysed production. Under the agreement, 33,000 workers in Washington state will receive a 38% pay rise during the next 4 years. A BBC investigation has found senior doctors are charging the NHS premium rates for overtime, with some being paid more than £200 an hour. NHS England said hospitals had to offer rates that were competitive with the private sector. Plans have been announced to extend the smoking ban to some outdoor spaces in England, including at playgrounds and near schools and hospitals. But the proposals won't include pub gardens. The bill, first proposed by the Conservatives, also includes plans to limit vaping and gradually phase out the sale of tobacco. Nearly 600 police officers were sacked and barred from returning to work in the year to March. Figures from the College of Policing show that's 50% more than the previous year. And Britain's competition watchdog has said the merger between the two mobile firms Vodafone and Three could go ahead if the two stick to commitments to invest in Britain's infrastructure. The watchdog said the pledge involving £11 billion of investment would boost competition.
Alan, thank you. 25 to 8 is the time. Let us listen one more time to their closing arguments. The words Kamala Harris and Donald Trump want to be ringing in the ears of Americans voting today.
But my message to you and to all Americans tonight is very simple. We do not have to live this way. We don't have to live this way. We're not living good. 4 years, what did they do that was good? Can you name one thing? I said to a group of people, what have they done? Everything's a disaster.
As president, I pledge to seek common ground and common sense solutions to the challenges you face. I am not looking to score political points. I am looking to make progress.
So, what happens now, tonight and in the days ahead? Anita Dunn is a friend and confidant of Joe Biden. She served in his White House. She's been working to support the Harris campaign.
What you will see on election night will potentially be, you know, the seven battleground states, which all get counted at different paces. You know, Georgia and North Carolina and Michigan will probably have results earlier than some of the other states. But I think what you will see will be a very, very close vote, and that people who expect to know what happened tomorrow night on Tuesday night will probably be frustrated. And the key here, of course, as it was in 2020, is the fact that it is taking a long time does not mean that there's any malfeasance here, that somebody is stealing an election.
What do you think of the poll in Iowa, this poll that's got a lot of publicity and the Democrats are very pleased about because it suggests that Kamala Harris might even win Iowa, which is a state she wasn't, under any suggestion from anyone, going to win. But the poll is interesting, isn't it? Because it suggests that women, particularly older women, seem to be breaking for her in a way that polling hasn't picked up and might be relevant in other places. Do you think that was a rogue poll or do you think it's telling us something?
I think women are going to be the key to this election, and that the gender gap that we talk about here is one about women in the United States who in 2022, in 2023, and now in 2024 are really rising up against the Supreme Court and what they did in the Dobbs decision, taking away a woman's right to make decisions about her own body, an overall attitude that women in this country feel that the Republican Party has towards them. And this election may very well be revenge of the women.
What has Kamala Harris failed to do when it comes to her campaign? And I suppose I'm thinking particularly about the question of whether she could have separated herself more from a president who is, whatever you think of him, and you think a lot of him, and you worked closely for him, he is unpopular. Could she have done more, do you think, to separate herself from him?
Well, I look at Vice President Harris's campaign, and I see a campaign that in a very short period of time made this an extremely competitive race with a vote probably trending a little towards her here in the closing hours of the election, and that it has been as close to a flawless campaign as I can remember in American politics, and it's also the closest campaign. And, you know, let's not forget, she's running as vice president of the Biden-Harris administration in a very difficult time for incumbents. And you've seen that in Europe. You've seen that in your own country. We've certainly seen it in the United States, that this is a tough time to be the incumbent party, the party in power. And she is basically running as the change candidate with a change electorate.
We were talking to Jim Messina on the program, the man who organized Barack Obama's 2012 re-election.
Yes.
And he was saying that, actually a year ago, he told our program that Democrats were praying for Donald Trump to be on the ticket because they thought he was easily beatable. It hasn't turned out that way, has it? Why not?
Former President Trump has political strengths that are unique to him, that haven't been able to translate to his party, but that people, above all else, associate him as president with a time in this country where they felt things were just going better, and that is pre-pandemic. But the reality is they associate Donald Trump with 2019 and a time when they feel like prices were lower, gas was cheap, groceries were cheap, you know, rents were lower, and things were better. And so that has been the extraordinary power of his candidacy, has been his ability to kind of evoke this emotion of a better time.
And if he wins, that's why, do you think?
I think if he wins, that's absolutely why.
And let us continue with that thought, because I also talked to Brian Lanza, who's a senior advisor to the Trump campaign. Did he agree with Anita Dunn that if Donald Trump wins, it will be down primarily to his economic message?
Anita is a very smart woman, and she's right by saying it's the economy, stupid. The vast majority of people have not gone over the fact that inflation has wiped out their savings. They haven't gone over the fact that inflation has caused them to max out their credit cards. They haven't gone over the fact that, you know, when they go grocery shopping, they have to buy less food. And so, yeah, you know, Americans do have a long-term memory with respect to, you know, their pocketbooks.
So the economy matters. Does culture matter as well, the wider culture, social issues?
It does, in a sense that it's America's going through some cultural changes, and some people aren't ready for those changes, and some people are willing to embrace it. I mean, culture matters a lot. I mean, the mentality of winning, sort of the winning culture that America's known for, sort of the manifest destiny, that's being lost with the Biden-Harris administration. You know, listen, Americans aren't apologetic for the soft power or for the economic power that they have. They want to help everybody. But I think, you know, the culture changes that are taking place here with Harris and Biden, it's not that they don't want to help everybody. They want to create a level playing field for everybody. They want everybody equals. And that's not what America is. You know, America is every person putting their best opportunity for it and creating something worthwhile for the world. So culturally, we are changing and we're rejecting that culture.
The risk for Donald Trump, though, is that that message appeals to men in particular who do not vote. They don't get to the polling stations. And that, for you, is the thing, isn't it, that could be the difference between winning and losing?
No, listen, I would say this. You know, the chief financial officer of every household is the mother. She's also the chief medical officer for every household. So the woman knows exactly how much they're paying for milk. So they know that they're paying more under Biden-Harris for milk than they were under Donald Trump.
So, but they're overwhelmingly supporting Harris.
Sure, but that's always been the case. There's always been a gender gap in Republican politics, dating back to Ronald Reagan. People were claiming he can't win with the gender gap being in the double digits that it is, and he won. George Herbert Walker Bush won with the gender gap, the women being where it is. George W. Bush won with the gender gap twice. And so, the gender gap can sort of create a lot of noise, but what we've seen over the years, and there's been few examples to the opposite, that the gender gap actually plays out in presidential politics. The reality is with this race, if we don't have all the women that we would have had before, we are expanding that electorate. We're now getting more of the Latino vote than we've ever received. We're now getting more of the Asian vote that we've ever received. We're now getting more of the Black vote that we've ever received. So if we have lost some, inroads, but we've made up for those gains in other demographics, and that's why we're going to win tomorrow.
Let me put to you some advice from Nigel Farage, Donald Trump's great friend and supporter, the British politician, who has told Britain's Daily Telegraph newspaper, if it's clear and decisive, the result, maybe it's time for Donald Trump to go off and play golf. In other words, don't challenge the result. Is that advice you think Donald Trump will take?
Listen, if we have a fair and free election without any interference, without any cheating, then yes, President Trump has always said that. But the problem is in the modern elections, we just haven't had that. Fraud is
prevalent. But hold on, are you saying already, though, and is he saying already clearly to the American people, this election is fixed, it is not a fair election?
I think what he's saying, and the election's not over, so it's hard to call it one way or the other, but what he is saying right now is that we're witnessing election fraud in front of our eyes that cannot be dismissed.
Brian Lanza, thanks very much for talking to us.
It is now 7:45. Let us turn to Thought for the Day, and our speaker this morning is Tina Beattie, writer and Catholic theologian.
Good morning. Some people will be looking forward to this evening's Guy Fawkes celebrations with fireworks lighting up the autumn sky. For others, Bonfire Night is an endurance test. I'm scared of fireworks, so I'll be cowering indoors with my fingers in my ears. This will be a terrifying night for family, pets and wildlife, and for people who have lived in war zones, whose trauma is reactivated by every explosion. But the ambiguity of Guy Fawkes goes deeper than a fear of fireworks. We might ask how a potentially catastrophic act of what today we would call terrorism became a nationwide excuse for a party. When Catholics were experiencing persecution under the Protestant King James I, Guido Fawkes and his Catholic co-conspirators plotted to kill the king and others by blowing up Parliament during its state opening on the 5th of November 1605. The plot was foiled and those involved were tortured and killed. A few months later, the king passed a Thanksgiving Act calling for a special church service, bonfires and fireworks to celebrate his deliverance. Thankfully, today such sentiments are not part of the many communal fireworks displays. However, we're naive if we believe that this story is too far in the past to worry us today. Many people living under oppression commit violent acts of resistance and suffer terrible punishments. Democracy is a fragile and vulnerable defence against such tyranny. It's easily destroyed by being allowed to wither because of apathy. That's why voting in general elections is an awesome responsibility for citizens of the world's democracies, especially in these volatile times. Christians pray for God's kingdom to come on earth as it is in heaven. This idea has been used to justify the conquest of peoples and the building of empires in the name of Christian civilization. Some today are once again promoting this politicized version of Christianity. Against such abuses of religious and political power are Christians who dedicate themselves to the quest for justice and peace, inspired by the radical vulnerability and love of God that they see revealed in the life, death and resurrection of Jesus. Responsible citizenship means people of faith must balance what they believe to be eternally true about the love and justice of God with the pragmatic compromises needed to ensure that the quest for justice is embedded within society's imperfect but necessary institutions, laws and policies. As Americans go to the polls, weighing personal, community and national concerns, much is made of the role that Christians and other faith groups will play in determining the outcome. How might their understanding of the nature of righteousness influence their vote today? The world is watching with bated breath.
Tina Beatty, Catholic theologian, with Thought for the Day at 13 minutes to 8. A BBC investigation has discovered some senior doctors are being paid at four times their normal rates when they do overtime for the NHS. Overtime is required if the government is to meet its goal of thousands more appointments and procedures a week and getting waiting lists down. The NHS overtime bill is now around £1 billion a year, and NHS England says the health service is competing with the private sector for consultants. Today, the government is introducing legislation banning cigarettes from being legally sold to anyone born from 2009 onwards, but it will not be banning smoking in pub gardens or outside bars and restaurants. When I spoke to the Health and Social Care Secretary, Wes Streeting, I started with that choice. Why not bring in that part of the ban?
Well, this is the biggest public health measure introduced in a generation. The bill has come back stronger than when it appeared before the general election, but it will create Britain's first ever smoke-free generation by phasing out smoking for children growing up in Britain today. They will never legally be able to buy cigarettes, the first act of its kind anywhere in the world. So this will be a world-leading measure. We're clamping down on vaping, particularly the scourge of addiction to vaping that we are seeing amongst children and young people, expanding the areas that people are not able to smoke or vape. But on hospitality, which was a measure that was floated in the newspapers over the course of the summer, as with all of the public health measures we're weighing up as a government, we weighed up the upside to taking such action in terms of deterring smoking and preventing harms from smoking, and the downside risks. I mean, I wouldn't generally commend leaks, internal government policy debates, but one of the consequences of the leak of that particular discussion is it meant that over the summer and in recent weeks, we've been able to have a discussion with the hospitality sector, with members of parliament, reflecting on some of the challenges facing UK hospitality today. And to therefore take a decision that we won't go ahead with an outdoor ban. That's not something we're going to consult on
the hospitality at this stage. The downside to the hospitality industry essentially became more important to the government. Because when it was first leaked in August that you were considering a ban on smoking in pub gardens, the Prime Minister went on the record to remind everyone that 80,000 people lose their lives to smoking every year, that it's a huge burden on the NHS and the taxpayer. So, yes, he said, we are going to take decisions in this space. So did the hospitality industry prevail on you in the end?
Well, I'd say two things. Firstly, everything the Prime Minister said in the summer was absolutely right. We shouldn't lose sight of the fact that for all of the progress we've seen, smoking is the number one cause of preventable death in this country. It is uniquely addictive. And that's why we are going further than previous governments, both by phasing out the availability of cigarettes and tobacco to create the first ever smoke-free generation, which in itself will be a historic and game-changing act when it comes to public health. We are also banning smoking outside schools, hospitals, playgrounds. So we'll be consulting on that following the passage of the bill through Parliament, as well as clamping down on the scourge of youth vaping.
Children are in pub gardens, aren't they? They will be exposed to secondhand smoke in pub gardens.
Well, sometimes children are in pub gardens. But look, we've had to, and this is the approach we're taking across the board when it comes to public health. There are lots of things that we can and will do on public health that don't impact on people's liberties or people's livelihoods. Where they do impact on people's liberties or people's livelihoods, you have to weigh up the evidence on the upside risks and also the evidence and the arguments on the downside risks. And that, I think that's the approach that we've taken during the debate about this particular measure. People will agree, people will disagree. And of course, there'll be a consultation in the usual way, a genuine consultation following the passage of the bill through Parliament. So there's still plenty of opportunity for people to have their say.
I know that you have your own experience of cancer, and we have Sir Chris Hoy talking to the BBC about his experience of prostate cancer, and particularly how he does have a family history. His father and his grandfather had the disease, and he is asking about earlier access to testing for men in that position, men who have a family history at the age of 45, perhaps, rather than 50. Are you persuaded by that?
I think he makes a very compelling case. I've asked the NHS to look at whether we are currently in the right place when it comes to screening. So that's something that we're actively looking at. And actually one of many reasons why Chris Hoy's openness about his own experience with cancer, his family's experience with cancer, I think has been so impactful, because it moments like this, especially where you've got a high profile case and someone who's willing to talk as openly as he is about his situation, I think it prompts a good debate about whether or not we've got the screening and the early diagnosis in the right place. And also, I think there'll be lots of people who are living with cancer who will take a great deal of comfort in how he's approaching his own cancer journey as well. And certainly I found it extremely moving, and I'm sure I'm not the only one.
Also today, a BBC investigation has discovered that some senior doctors are being paid at four times their normal rates when they do overtime for the NHS. What do you think of that?
I think we're paying a very heavy price for poorly planned care. We paid a very heavy price for NHS strikes, because many of those consultants and many of those high cost shifts were consultants stepping in during the action taken by junior doctors, now known as resident doctors. So the country paid a very heavy price for the mismanagement of our predecessors, the previous Conservative government. And that's why we've got to get a grip. I'm very proud of the fact that within weeks of taking office, we took the necessary steps to end that strike action. I've had criticism from my Conservative predecessor, a bit like the arsonist complaining about the fire brigade turning up and not doing the job well enough.
This is a different point, isn't it? This is a specific point. I know you've said previously that trust should pay staff around time and a half for the additional shifts required to hit your manifesto pledge for an extra 40,000 appointments a week. So what do you think of the fact that some are charging up to four times their normal rates?
Well, I'd say two things. Firstly, it is not a separate point. I make the point again that we paid a very heavy price for strike action, and people who are criticising me for settling the junior doctors' strike should explain why they think the country should continue to have paid such a heavy financial price, as well as a price to patients in terms of delayed operations, appointments and procedures.
But are these kinds of rates acceptable?
But no, I don't think these kinds of rates are acceptable. And that brings me on to the second point, which is every penny that goes into the NHS needs to be money that is well spent. I think that context was set out plainly in the budget. The NHS was the standout winner in the budget in terms of the money allocated to it. But I can tell you that there are plenty of other ways that money could have been spent with impact. And that's why the NHS owes it to the country to make sure that every penny is well spent.
Can you stop it being spent in this way you consider to be unacceptable? A spokeswoman for NHS England has defended the amounts being paid out in overtime, saying it's a competitive market.
Look, I think it's not just a change of government that we needed at the last election. It's a change of mindset now.
In the NHS?
The NHS cannot continue to be a black hole for limited amounts of taxpayers' money. We've got to make sure that money is well spent. And that's why I think through a combination of reform, better planned care and a better relationship with the medical professions, I think we can get back to a sensible point. Where people are doing overtime, I think it is reasonable that they are paid more than through their planned shifts, because they're doing the NHS a good turn, as
but
I think exists in other contexts.
Not more than a time and a half, which you've previously said.
I think if you had a consultant on your programme, I think they would find it hard to defend those sorts of rates.
They might say they're really overworked, and if you really want them to do this overtime, you're going to have to incentivise them.
Well, I think that's where incentives for overtime do have a place. I also think, by the way, this is why this government was elected on a mandate of investment and reform to turn the NHS around, to make sure it's got the staff, the equipment and the tools it needs to do the job.
West Streeting, thank you. Well, this investigation by our health correspondent Nick Triggle and by BBC Verify is on the BBC website now, so you'll find all the details of how they've worked out these figures within that. The British Medical Association, the Doctors' Union, has pointed out that the NHS would not have to rely so much on overtime were it not for staffing shortages. And hospitals have said that covering for strike days and sickness have also been factors in the overall size of the overtime bill in the last year.
On BBC iPlayer.
Of all the wonderful places in the world, one continent holds more riches than any other. Asia has the world's highest mountains, the hottest place on the Earth's surface, the richest concentration of marine life, a trillion trees, and more people than in the rest of the world combined.
Asia with David Attenborough.
There's nowhere else on Earth with so many untold stories.
Watch on BBC iPlayer.
To the weather, and Simon brings it to us.
I do indeed. Justin, good morning. There's not much rain in the forecast through this week. Perhaps some in western areas might get some over the weekend. But before then, it is going to remain dry, but it's not exactly sunny. It's not been sunny over the last few days. And this morning, it's pretty cloudy. We've got some mist and some fog out there, particularly across parts of southwest England. So for southwest England, southeast and eastern England, the mist and the fog will gradually lift up. The visibilities will improve for many. And while it'll stay fairly grey and overcast for most of the day, there could be a few holes developing in the cloud. Temperatures getting to 16 degrees in Plymouth, 14 in Bath and London, and 13 Celsius in Norwich. For Wales and the Midlands, a bit of mist and a few fog patches again, especially on the hills. Most of this will clear away pretty quickly through this morning, but again, it's going to stay pretty cloudy for most of us. There may well be some breaks in the cloud across North and East Wales into the afternoon, so a few sunny spells, and temperatures of 14 degrees in Cardiff and 13 in Birmingham. For northwest and northeast England, once again, some mist and some hill fog. That's going to clear and, again, pretty overcast throughout the morning. A few brighter skies, perhaps developing later on, especially towards the west of the Pennines. Highs of 13 Celsius in Manchester and Leeds and 12 degrees in Newcastle. For Northern Ireland, central and southern Scotland, mist clears away. It's going to stay grey and overcast, 12 or 13 degrees. And for northern Scotland, a bit of drizzle early on, actually, but that's going to clear. And across northern Scotland, this is where we're going to have the best of the sunshine today, and highs of 9 to 12 Celsius.
Simon, thank you very much. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 from Washington and from London.
It's 8 o'clock on Tuesday, the 5th of November. The headlines this morning: Donald Trump and Kamala Harris have made their closing pitches to American voters as millions prepare to go to the polls in one of the closest fought presidential races in living memory. I've been speaking to voters in the swing states of Pennsylvania and North Carolina.
Madam Vice President has made it a point to reach out to everyone.
The only candidate on the ticket that is representing my values and Latino values is Donald Trump today.
When all the votes are counted, that's what matters to me, because ain't nobody called my house and asked me who I was voting for.
And a BBC investigation has found that pressure to cut waiting lists has led to some senior doctors earning more than £200,000 in overtime in just a year.
Also coming up before nine, can artificial intelligence be used to translate novels into English? One publisher is about to try it. And family histories of prostate cancer. We'll talk to Lord Dobbs about Sir Chris Hoy's experience and his call for testing at a younger age. The BBC News is read by Alan Smith.
The candidates in the US presidential election have made their final pitches to voters, with millions expected to head to the polls in the coming hours. The outcome is predicted to be tight and is likely to be decided by seven swing states, with opinion polling suggesting no clear victor. Kamala Harris focused her final effort in Philadelphia in Pennsylvania, saying her campaign appealed to the aspirations and dreams of the American people. Our correspondent Tom Bateman was watching.
Welcome the next president of these United States, Kamala Harris!
Well, the crowd is many, many thousands strong at this final push by the Harris campaign to get its vote out here in perhaps the most critical of swing states. And their candidate, hand in hand with Oprah Winfrey, is making her way to the stage.
America is ready for a fresh start, ready for a new way forward where we see our fellow American not as an enemy, but as a neighbor. And we are ready for a president who knows that the true measure of a leader is not based on who you beat down, but based on who you lift up.
The speech was focused on optimism and hope. The Harris campaign thinks that creates a clear counterpoint to what they assert are the shadowy, foreboding messages of her rival. In reality, both campaigns have dwelt on claims of dystopian prospects if they lose. While Kamala Harris has outperformed Joe Biden's poll ratings before the Democrats ousted him as their candidate, she hasn't broken the deadlock with Donald Trump right up to Election Day.
The former president, Donald Trump, made Michigan his final stop, where he was boosted by an endorsement from the influential podcaster Joe Rogan. Our correspondent Ione Wells sent this report from Michigan.
When I spoke to Donald Trump supporters in the queue for his final rally, the same themes came up again and again. Close the borders, improve the economy. It's no surprise when speaking to his fans that he chose to focus on immigration and the economy in his closing pitch.
Your paychecks will be higher, your streets will be safer and cleaner, your communities will be richer, and your future will be brighter than ever before. This will be the golden age of America.
He also used the final day of his campaign to repeat unfounded claims that his opponents were cheating. His critics say he's laying the ground to challenge the result if he loses. His last rally in Michigan was in a city that was once a Republican stronghold, but turned Democrat in 2020. In other parts of the state that used to be Democrat, voters have told me they're switching to Donald Trump because they back his immigration and economic policies.
Our North America editor Sarah Smith says many in the US are nervous about the coming days.
No one knows who's likely to emerge the winner. We don't know when a result will be declared, as it could take days to get a final vote count from some of the key battleground states like Pennsylvania. And there's also trepidation about how people might react to the result. The National Guard's on standby in Washington State, Oregon and Nevada in case of civil unrest. And security barriers have been erected outside the White House and other sites around the Capitol. Voters say they are exhausted by this tumultuous campaign and want it to be over, but are also apprehensive about what may happen next.
The Polish authorities have warned that incendiary packages placed on cargo flights earlier this year were possible practice runs by Russia's spy agency for attacks on transatlantic planes. One package caught fire in a warehouse in Birmingham in July, another on the ground in Germany, and two more were found in Poland. Russia has denied involvement. Here's our security correspondent Frank Gardner.
More details are now emerging about a series of arson attacks that Western intelligence officials suspect were part of an orchestrated campaign by Russia's military intelligence agency, the GRU. The authorities in Poland now believe this was a practice run for future devices to be placed on planes bound for the US and Canada. Packages containing erotic gadgets and massage pillows appear to have been used as cover to smuggle highly dangerous incendiary devices onto cargo routes destined for Western Europe. One ignited at a DHL warehouse outside Birmingham, another in Leipzig in Germany, a third in Warsaw, and a fourth was intercepted by the Polish authorities.
Workers at the US aircraft manufacturer Boeing have voted to accept a deal to end a seven-week walkout. More than half backed the agreement, which will see staff receive a 38% pay rise during the next 4 years. A BBC investigation has found senior doctors are charging the NHS premium rates for overtime, with some making more than £200,000 extra every year for the additional work. The Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, told us some of the rates being paid weren't acceptable. Here's our health correspondent, Nick Triggle.
The government has made tackling the hospital backlog a priority, promising to put on extra clinics at weekends and evenings in England. But the BBC investigation found the NHS is having to pay the most senior doctors significant sums to do additional work. Rates exceeding £200 an hour, more than four times normal pay, are being charged. The British Medical Association defended the rates, saying staffing shortages were to blame. Hospitals said covering strikes and sickness absence were also factors, and they were trying to bear down on the highest rates of pay.
The government has announced plans to extend the smoking ban in enclosed public places in England to outdoor areas close to schools, hospitals and children's playgrounds. Vaping could also be barred in these areas. But ministers have decided not to outlaw smoking in pub gardens. Wes Streeting told us the government was taking a balanced approach.
Today, with the Tobacco and Vapes Bill, we'll be introducing to Parliament a piece of legislation that will be the biggest breakthrough in public health in a generation. This has been happily, and I hope it will continue to be, an area of cross-party consensus. What we're doing on public health across the board is considering both the evidence around the upsides to taking action, but also taking into account any downsides.
Meeting the government's target of using clean electricity by 2030 will be a huge challenge, but is achievable, according to a report commissioned by the Energy Secretary, Ed Miliband. The National Energy System Operator says the switch could deliver real benefits to consumers, but would require major investment. Our climate editor, Justin Rowlatt, has the details.
This report can be read as both a call to action and a riposte to the many critics in industry and elsewhere who say the 2030 target is impossible. The National Energy System Operator says clean sources could produce all the electricity the UK needs by 2030. Costs do not need to rise and may even fall, it concludes. It'll take £40 billion a year of new investment and will require industry, government, regulators and the electricity system operator to work together and to work fast. There will be benefits, though. The UK's high electricity prices should become less volatile as the link with international gas markets is broken.
Figures from the College of Policing show that nearly 600 officers were sacked and barred from returning to work in England and Wales in the year to March. That's a 50% rise compared with the previous year, amid heightened concern about the culture in some forces. Here's our UK correspondent, Adina Campbell.
Dishonesty was the most common reason for being kicked out of the police force. Sexual offences, misconduct and discriminatory behaviour were among the other reasons given. 593 police officers were sacked and told they were not allowed to return in the 12 months to March this year, up from almost 400 the previous year. The number sacked is less than 5% of the overall workforce in England and Wales. But senior police leaders say they're committed to getting rid of officers who aren't fit to serve the public.
The six-time Olympic cycling champion Sir Chris Hoy says he wants young men to be screened for prostate cancer to try to save millions of lives. In his first in-depth interview since making his terminal diagnosis public, Sir Chris, who's 48, said he hoped there would be a surge of people coming forward for testing. He wants those with a family history of prostate cancer to be screened.
It's logical to me that why would you not just get the test a little bit earlier, catch it before you need to have any major treatment? So it's, to me, it seems a no-brainer. Why would they not allow more men to just go in and get a blood test? Maybe people seeing this or hearing about my story and then just by them asking their GP will create enough of a surge of interest that the people that make decisions will go, do you know what, we need to address this.
That was Sir Chris Hoy.
Alan, thank you. It is 8:10. Enough of the clichés, the crucial swing states, the close polls, the messaging, the endless carnival fueled by billions of dollars of attack ads and podcast appearances and interviews and gaffes and fluffs and events, big events like assassination attempts, a change of candidate as well, and all the small events too, in which the candidates' surrogates tried to garner just a few added votes. Today is polling day. And then, in theory, later tonight, perhaps not for some days, we will know who has won. And the course that America takes will be set. I've been in two of those fabled swing states. North Carolina, which Trump ought to win and has visited every day for the last few days. And Pennsylvania, which Harris has to win in order to get a realistic path to the magic number of 270 electoral college votes, the number needed to scrape a win. She spent the whole of the last day of campaigning in Pennsylvania. And we begin in Reading, Pennsylvania, which both candidates visited on the last day of the campaign with the views of the voters they were trying to persuade.
Some things never change. College football.
and the huge enthusiasm there is for it, and the cheerleaders and the excitement. But this place, Reading, is changing. Its community is changing. Majority Latino now, and Latino people who live there are beginning to use their political muscle.
Eddie Moran, mayor of the city of Reading. The first Latino Puerto Rican mayor of this beautiful city. I don't think it's any longer a secret that the next president of the United States is going to be determined by Pennsylvania and specifically by the Latino vote.
When you look at the population of this city and you look at this election and you look particularly at the Latino population of this city, how solid are they for Kamala Harris?
The state of Pennsylvania has 1.2 million Latinos. 600,000 of those are registered voters. Out of those 600,000, about 400,000 are Puerto Rican. Not many of them were coming out to vote in the past. Madam Vice President has made it a point to reach out to everyone. She resonates with the needs of the community, which are basic home ownership, financial stability, health care, child care. She has made an effort to reach out to the Latino community to make sure that we are included, that we are valued and accepted like any other American.
There's no question at all. Donald Trump's campaign knows that places like this matter and could make all the difference. Just outside his campaign headquarters now in the center of Reading with its posters, Latino Americans for Trump, Trump safety, Kamala crime, stop illegal voting, only citizens vote, etc., etc. And what they say here is that the enthusiasm in these last few days has been with them.
Hi, my name's Steve. I am a Trump team captain with Trump Force 47. Outreach to the Latino community has been fantastic. More positive than we would have ever expected. Reading and Berks County is the nucleus that can make the difference in winning this state. They all say it, both sides. Pennsylvania is the key to this election.
Good morning, Reading.
Please take your seat.
Thank you.
We've come on board the Trump bus, which is what I'm going to call it. It's actually the bus that's supporting a person who's running for Congress from the Republican Party. But you're also all Trump supporters, aren't you? May I ask you your name and who you're going to vote for?
My name is Sarah Torres, and I live here in Reading, and I'm going to vote for Donald Trump and straight Republican down the ticket. Because he represents my values. I was born and raised in Puerto Rico. And the only candidate on the ticket that is representing my values and Latino values is Donald Trump today.
And when you say Latino values, what are they?
Family first, economy, take care of your own, making our country better for my son who just started college, and also pro-life.
Are you worried at all when he talks about deporting illegal immigrants, that there is a risk to the wider Latino community that comes from that?
We see immigration and illegal immigration in a different way. What have happened with illegal immigration the last 3.5 years is insane. We have people coming from all over the place. We have people from Iran coming in. We have people from India. We have people from Europe, China, you name it. They're here. My view on it and my family's view is close the border completely now. Close it.
Vote Neil Young, the U.S. Congress.
If the big issue in this election turns out to be turnout, then here is a worry for both sides. We've come to the Café de Colombia in the center of Reading to talk to two people of Puerto Rican descent. Eli is from the right, Ruby is from the left. They're going to vote Democrat and Republican, but each of them not to vote for the person at the top of the ticket.
I was going to vote for Donald Trump. What happened in Madison Square Garden?
So this is the comic in Madison Square Garden. It's a Trump rally. The comedian says that Puerto Rico is an island of garbage. You are originally from Puerto Rico.
I have family in Puerto Rico, and that was insulting. Someone needed to be fired.
Do you just had a real impact? I mean, you feel the way you feel, but do others?
Absolutely. I have many friends that are Democrat that weren't going to vote, now they're voting for Kamala.
If this election in this state is decided by 10,000, 20,000, 30,000 votes, which it may well be, that joke could be quite costly.
That joke could have been the difference in him winning or losing. And don't get me wrong, I wish he would win, but I'm leaving the fate to God.
What is it that's stopping you voting for Kamala Harris?
I can't turn a blind eye on everything that is happening in Palestine. And the U.S. is part in that. She still has the opportunity to call for an immediate and permanent ceasefire and arms embargo.
And what's really interesting about that is that you are a Latino voter, and a lot of the people you're talking about will be Latinos. We associate those views with Michigan and with Arab Americans, but you're saying here in Pennsylvania, another swing state, and among a different community, it is still a big deal.
Yeah, it absolutely is.
So these are people who would have voted for a Democratic presidential candidate, perhaps have done in the past, but are not going to this time round because of what's going on in the Middle East.
Yeah, because they share the same sentiments that I do.
Time to leave the state. Kamala Harris must win Pennsylvania and travel to North Carolina, a must for the Trump team.
We would like to be the first to welcome you to Charlotte. As a reminder, please stay seated with your seatbelt fastened until the seatbelt sign is off. Keep the aisle clear of all items.
We've come to a black church on the edge of Charlotte, North Carolina, and as you can hear, the place is buzzing, and these places used to be able to deliver the vote to the Democrats pretty convincingly. Can they still? The next speaker certainly hopes they can.
He is none other than the 42nd President of the United States of America, Mr. William Jefferson Clinton.
I don't want you to feel any pressure, but the whole future of the country... It could be riding on the turnout in Mecklenburg County. You don't want to wake up Wednesday wishing you'd done one thing or another. God bless you and thank you.
Okay, we're leaving the church now and going out into the sunshine. And what was really interesting about Bill Clinton's message is that it was aimed not at the people in the church, but at the people they might know outside the church, because that is the issue. Can they persuade enough members of their family, friends as well, to get to the polls?
Well, my family, I come from a family, we take voting very seriously. Because back in my day, we died for the right. So my family takes it very, very seriously.
Do you feel, though, that this time round there has been a reduction, which is what the polls tell us, isn't
well,
it? A reduction in
said,
support,
baby,
particularly
polls,
by young black people.
That's what the polls
people.
Are saying. But November 5th, when all the votes are counted, that's what matters to me, because ain't nobody called my house and asked me who I was voting for. So I don't put a whole lot of stock in the polls, okay?
As we were sitting in church and he was talking, I felt the urge to text my network and ask them, have they voted? And they say, hey, make sure you get out and vote and make sure you vote your interest.
Do you think it'll work?
I do. I do think it'll work. I think it will.
We've come outside Charlotte in rural North Carolina to Gaston County, where Donald Trump has been in recent days. This is the place, if the Republicans win here, that will be the cause of the victory. They will get enough people in places like this to the polls. So how confident are they? They normally win this state for their presidential candidate. Barack Obama won it in 2008, but generally in modern times it does lean Republican. Will it again this year?
My name is Mark Seelinger. I'm the former mayor of Belmont and heavily involved in local Republican politics here.
When you look at the last few hours of all of this, what is keeping you up at night? What do you feel good about?
We're just down the road from Charlotte, and, you know, a lot of it's kind of going to hinge on how many people turn out in the big cities.
Hand on heart here, have you got what it takes to get those final straggling voters, as it were, to the polls for Donald Trump?
I mean, Gaston County has been an important part of Republican victories in North Carolina for the past few cycles, and I think that we'll continue to put numbers on the board that the rest of the state will need.
Hello there, folks. We're talking to people about the election. I don't know if you've got anything to say about it.
I'll be glad when it's over.
You'll be glad when it's over. Well, there's a start. There's a start.
Yeah. Why will you be glad when it's over?
Oh, man. Yeah, being a Christian, I look at it like King Nebuchadnezzar and Jezebel going head to head. Who has the platform that best pleases God? And the platform I feel is the one that's against abortion, against family values, gender, those type things.
Right, so that is Donald Trump's platform.
That's his platform. As far as a person, I mean, you know, there's hard things to like about him, but I got to go from the Christian aspect of it, and he's runs the platform that furthers his agenda here on Earth.
Hello ladies, we're from the BBC in London. We're asking people about the election. Do you have any views?
I hope we have a new president on Tuesday. I hope he wins.
What is it that attracts him to you?
That he's not a politician, he's a businessman.
Here in North Carolina, how tight is it? Give us a kind of sense of this state and how you think it lies.
Normally, I would always say we've been a red state, always. But this year, I'm not quite sure. A lot of people are moving to the South, and they're bringing their politics down here. So it's not just Southerners here in North Carolina. Quite a hodgepodge of people.
That's interesting. So. And that happened, of course, in Virginia, didn't it?
Yes.
And changed the politics of Virginia.
Yes, it did. Yes.
And it's coming to this state, too.
I think it might.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for coming.
Justin reporting from two of the key states. So, Justin, give us a sense of the timings then. By this time tomorrow, what will we know?
Well, there'll be straws in the wind because there'll be some individual results, some individual counties where the votes will have been tabulated and the networks will be saying this, that and the other about them and some suggestions of what has been important to voters in certain parts of those places where the results are coming in. But nothing much firm until we begin to have states called. And the two big ones, which we were talking about earlier on in the programme, seem to me to be Georgia and North Carolina. So North Carolina, where I just was then and where Donald Trump really needs to win, and Georgia as well. Georgia at about midnight our time, North Carolina half an hour or so later. Not that they'll be called as soon as the polls end then, but that we are being told that the voting procedures have been improved in both of those places. So it is likely, actually, assuming they're not a dead heat and a recount, that actually something will be able to be said a few hours after the polls have finished. Yeah. In other words, in the early hours of the morning, British time.
OK, that's useful to know. But on these procedures, so it's not just about how fast they can count, but about any perceptions of irregularity. And I was struck that you were saying earlier that some legal challenges have already been filed.
Well, I mean, yes, they certainly have. And the problem there is each state has its own rules when it comes to the way that the vote is counted. And some of them have speeded up those rules so that the vote can be counted, and particularly early votes counted, tabulated, sorted out during the course of the day so the result can come that evening. But some places haven't done that. And the crucial place that hasn't done it, because the legislature hasn't allowed it to happen, is the state of Pennsylvania, which is, of course, not only a complete dead heat, according to the polls, but is also the state that, if it went to either candidate, would probably propel them to the White House. So in Pennsylvania, you've already seen legal challenges about, I mean, things like the envelope that a vote is sent in on. Has it been properly dated? Should that mean that if it hasn't been dated, it's put to one side? All sorts of kind of what would seem like minor issues, except that if it comes down to 10,000 votes, 20,000 votes, plainly it's not a minor issue. And that means that there is room then for those legal challenges to go ahead, because they won't be able to say, and the networks won't be able to call who's won. And that, I suppose, is the danger for the election that so concerns Americans, that we have this situation where a very, very small numbers of states, or possibly just Pennsylvania, hold up the whole process.
Well, we'll have an overnight election programme here on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds, and then tomorrow morning you will be back with the programme live from Washington. But right now here, it's The Sport with Carthy.
Morning. Thank you very much. A few headlines to start. Two late goals in the 92nd and 97th minutes from substitute Harry Wilson snatched a 2-1 victory for Fulham against Brentford in the Premier League. Tonight, Manchester City are in Champions League action against Sporting. Their boss is Ruben Amorim, who is about to take charge of Manchester United. Liverpool host Bayer Leverkusen and Celtic face RB Leipzig. And you can keep up to date with all of tonight's European matches with commentary and updates on 5 Live Sport. Tennis, and the three-time Grand Slam champion Aryna Sabalenka has reached the semi-finals of the season-ending WTA finals in Riyadh after a straight sets win over the Wimbledon finalist Jasmine Paolini. That win puts Sabalenka one step closer to holding the year-end world number one ranking. Well, currently ranked world number one in the world are the England Women's Rugby Union team, a position they will want to hold on to ahead of next year's Rugby World Cup, which takes place in England. And I'm very pleased to say we can speak to the Rugby World Cup winner, Maggie Alfonsi. Morning. morning, Maggie.
Good morning.
Hello. The general ticket applications open today. I think numbers have been pretty good already for the opening game and for the final at Twickenham. Pre-sale pretty much sold out, I've been told. Take us back 10 years to when you won this title, this World Cup. How much has the women's game progressed since your World Cup win a decade ago?
Oh, so much has changed. I mean, when we first talk about ticket sales in particular, you know, 130,000 tickets have already been sold. And when I first started playing rugby, many women and girls didn't play. And then when you fast forward to 2014, when our England women's team won that World Cup, it was amazing. And it was here in England. And, you know, it was one venue, there was 12 teams, and there actually wasn't many people watching it in comparison to what we're going to see next year. You know, this is going to be the biggest Women's Rugby World Cup ever, in the fact that it's going to be 16 teams, you know, 8 cities, 8 venues, and it's going to be, you know, broadcasted, you know, across the world globally, which is something we haven't seen for a very long time. So I'm incredibly excited by it.
I can tell. World Cup matches are in venues from Sunderland and York to Exeter and Brighton. How much is that needed to continue interest and growth, particularly when we did see some empty seats at the last Women's World Cup in New Zealand? That atmosphere really does need to be created, doesn't it?
Yeah, look, you've got to take it across the country from the top to the bottom. And I think having 8 cities enables that, 8 venues does that, you know. And also when you look at the venues, they're football grounds, they're rugby league grounds, they're rugby union grounds. And that, again, brings a new, I guess, audience to the sport. And that's what we want to do with the women's game. We want to make sure that we grow it, and we want to make sure that we have a lasting impact that leaves a legacy.
Yeah, and in the last hour, just interested in your views on this, we discussed the tennis end-of-season tournament, the WTA Finals, which are being held in Riyadh. Obviously, there are human rights concerns, there's the criminalisation of the LGBTQ community. You are on the national board for the RFU Council, you're a national member of that, so governance is part of what you do. How much pressure do you think sport, and in particular women's sport, is coming under to accept money rather than, I suppose, follow their personal values?
It's incredibly challenging because when we talk about women's sport, regardless of the sport, we naturally want to grow it, you know, and we're reaching a point now where women's sport is growing. It's a global focus now and commercial opportunities are there. But then you're consistently being faced with these challenges where do you accept the money or do you focus on your moral compass? And I think the reality is now women's sport is at a difficult place where we have to strike that balance. You know, I can only talk for my own sport, which is rugby union, and the emphasis has always been to try and stick to your moral compass. But it's incredibly difficult, I guess, going forward, especially a sport like women's rugby or tennis or many other women's sport. You want to grow it. But I do truly believe that you've got to do what's right. You know, that's the reality of it. And it's interesting to see how the women's rugby, women's tennis continues to grow whilst having these questions constantly asked to them.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting point. You mentioned commercial opportunities there. England being the world number one ranked side is obviously a great opportunity ahead of the World Cup next year. Really appreciate your time this morning, Maggie Alfonsi, World Cup winner as well. And just to mention a bit of horse racing news, like old times. Knight's Choice has won Australia's famous Melbourne Cup with the results going to a photo finish. It was an Irish jockey, Robbie Dolan, who won. It was his first ride in the event and a second victory for the New Zealand trainer Sheila Laxon.
Carthy, thank you. Here's what's coming up at 9.
Hello, I'm Kirsty Young, and today on Young Again, I'm in conversation with the novelist Irvine Welsh. I'll be asking him what advice he would give to his younger self.
Be more in touch with your family. I wish I'd have sort of spent more time going up there and hanging out with them.
Join me this morning at 9 for Young Again on BBC Radio 4 and on BBC Sounds.
To the weather, largely cloudy, some patchy mist and fog to start today. Later, cloud is going to break up in spots, but some longer sunny spells will persist in northern Scotland.
Quite expansive for you in the weather forecast.
I didn't actually understand what I was reading by the end of it, but anyway. Mixed.
We'll work it out. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Justin Webb in Washington, Michelle Hussein in London, Alan Smith with the news.
The US presidential candidates Kamala Harris and Donald Trump have made their final appeals to American voters ahead of ballots being cast by millions in one of the tightest races in decades. Opinion polling puts the two rivals neck and neck. The Polish authorities have warned that explosive packages placed on cargo flights earlier this year were possible practice runs by Russia's spy agency for attacks on transatlantic planes. Moscow has denied involvement. A BBC investigation has found senior doctors are charging the NHS premium rates for overtime, with some being paid more than £200 an hour. NHS England said hospitals had to offer rates that were competitive with the private sector. But the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, told us some of the payments were unacceptable. And plans have been announced to extend the smoking ban to some outdoor spaces in England, including at playgrounds and near schools and hospitals. But the proposals won't include pub gardens.
Alan, thank you very much. It is just after 8:30. Sir Chris Hoy has told the BBC that men with a family history of prostate cancer, as he has, should be encouraged to get a test for the disease from the age of 45 rather than 50. Here's part of his interview with BBC Breakfast, where he explains what he's concluded since his diagnosis.
I believe that the screening for men with a strong family history of prostate cancer, it should be a lot younger. It's logical to me that why would you not just get the test a little bit earlier, catch it before you need to have any major treatment? To me, it seems a no-brainer. You know, why would they not reduce the age, bring the age down, allow more men to just go in and get a blood test?
His father and grandfather both had prostate cancer, and Sir Chris is now living with the reality that his cancer is stage 4 and terminal. Revealing his diagnosis sparked thousands of men coming forward to get tested. In 2021, Michael Dobbs, Lord Dobbs, Conservative peer and author of the House of Cards trilogy, used his Today programme guest edit to look at prostate cancer. He'd been diagnosed that year and the disease had killed his father and brother. He joins us now. Morning, Lord Dobbs.
Good morning, Michelle.
May I ask you first how you are doing more than 3 years on from your diagnosis?
Well, I was one of the fortunate many because of my father and my brothers dying from the disease. My GP, the wonderful man James Banfield, was looking for it, monitoring it, and so we caught it very early. And if you catch prostate cancer early, you have a more than 95% chance of surviving it. So early detection is absolutely the key to dealing with this challenge.
But presumably your GP knew that because you had mentioned it.
Yes, the problem with the system right now, I listen with tears and also huge joy and gratitude to Sir Chris's interview. The problem with the system right now is it requires you to go knocking on the door of your GP. I really do believe that with these figures, when prostate cancer, it's the most common form of male cancer, it's the second most deadly, the GPs, the NHS should be reaching out more proactively to say, come on in, you know, we're here to help you and we can help you if we catch it early.
And the point being then that you can get an earlier test if you ask for one, but people perhaps don't know that, haven't told their GPs their family history, or perhaps aren't, well, in some cases, perhaps don't know for sure what their own family history was.
Yeah, well, of course, there's another factor, Michelle, that we men are really rubbish at dealing with those sort of problems. We try to put them off. We try to ignore them. I mean, on my Today programme that I edited a couple of years ago, I talked to Bill Turnbull, who the lovely man who was so furious with himself for having ignored the symptoms for so long until it was too late. You know, his message, his example, Stephen Fry, Sir Chris's example of actually saying, look, this is a problem, deal with it, is inspiring many, many men to go out. And the contact rates with the NHS for people asking to be tested is getting stronger and stronger. And that's why more and more men are surviving this. But it does require, yes, at the moment, people to reach out to their GP, men to reach out and say, look, I've got to have to swallow some of the uncomfortable necessities of this and save my life.
Yeah, he was a dear friend of mine. And I do remember the reaction when he made his diagnosis public. And just as you say, we have these waves when people use their public profile, as Sir Chris has, to, you know, to cast a light on the disease. But it's not the same as having a national strategy that really reaches a huge range of the population all the time. What do you think about the idea of a nationwide screening programme? Because there have always been doubts about that and whether it leads to false positives and is essentially the wrong place to be on a population level.
It is a challenge because the traditional tests are not entirely reliable, and you do get many false positives, which means you could be told that you might have cancer. And of course, being told that you might have cancer and you don't has consequences. But I do believe that this is a manageable problem when you're talking to your GP. There is also, I must say, there are some very exciting developments in the wings where prostate testing is getting better and better, and we could, in a very short period of time, have a much more reliable test for it. But it does require a partnership between you as an individual man and your GP to actually have sensible conversations about these sort of things and weigh up the odds. Because otherwise, you're going to end up in poor Bill's circumstances, regretting, bitterly regretting the fact that he tried to ignore it. And he felt he'd let his, not only his life down, but his entire family down, which is, you know, it was so sad to listen to such a fine man suffering that way, unnecessarily.
Do you have a message for Chris Hoy today?
Oh, wow, yes. I mean, first of all, Chris, I want to thank you for what you're doing, because by coming out and being so public about it, you're empowering men and you are saving lives. You're encouraging people to save their own lives. And just a little story. I have another brother who also has prostate cancer. He was given 2 years to live. That was 4 years ago. And he is looking forward to celebrating Christmas with his family and in remarkably good shape. I mean, these things do get better. So I hope that both you and I will follow in his wheel tracks, and that our final laps, so to speak, will be long and joyous, because I certainly know that you deserve it for all the joy that you have brought to us.
Lord Dobbs, thank you.
22 minutes to nine. Why is today's American election close? Why is a convicted felon, a man so wild and reckless in his speech, so contemptuous of so much of American life, within grasp again of the White House? Might it be because the entire political class either failed to see something happening in American society, or did see it but did nothing about it? Professor Arlie Hochschild thinks that's exactly what happened. Her studies of the Trump phenomenon have been noticed by senior Democrats, though possibly too late to act on her advice. I asked her to set out the appeal of Donald Trump.
All the bad things that have happened to the whole nation have hit harder. The non-college class, I think all of those things over time have created a big prosperity divide between people with BAs and people without. That's the new knife that cuts our country.
People with BAs, people with four-year college degrees, and people without.
Exactly. That's the big one. And actually, recent research has shown that whites without BA degrees have actually sunk in the last two decades. So there's a sense of, gosh, I'm working hard, but I'm not getting there. And gosh, how come these other groups are doing better than me?
And I suppose politically, the obvious question would be, why didn't the Democrats see all of this happening and take action?
Yes, exactly, exactly. And in fact, you could say Bill Clinton, Democrat, you know, signed NAFTA and actually made it harder for the very people he thought he was and was seen as representing. So there's disappointment with the Democrats, but also labor unions used to be the middleman between the white working class and the Democratic Party. And now it's just 9% of the private sector workers are represented by unions. So that the main structure is gone and hasn't been replaced. So all of this has, I think, led people to kind of give up on either party. A sinking sector kind of thought, hey, the government, the regular government, doesn't see us, isn't answering our needs, either Republicans or Democrats. And so they turned to a charismatic figure. And charismatic leadership is really different from what Max Weber calls rational legal leadership. You know, a rational legal leader would be like Joe Biden, who says, hey, look, I did the Build Back Better bill. Look at the bill. You know, look at the Inflation Reduction Act. I did that. Look at that. Don't look at me. Whereas the charismatic leader, like Donald Trump, says, no, only look at me. I don't actually have a program, but I personally will represent your feelings.
Can I ask you this? A commentator was saying recently that with Richard Nixon, yes, he told lies, but in a sense he had a respect for the truth because he knew the difference between the truth and the lies. And with Donald Trump, this commentator was suggesting he actually doesn't know or care about the difference. He was comparing Trump, actually, to P.T. Barnum, the man who essentially invented circuses, that there's a kind of maelstrom of stuff going on, and that that in itself is interesting and very difficult to challenge.
Yes. You know, in a way, as we look to this election, Trump may lose the election, but in a way, he's already won a cultural victory of he's changed our feeling about the importance of feeling. You know, it's more important to feel something's true than to actually show it's true. And also, he's kind of changed what I would call the feeling rules. Like, it's okay to feel extremely angry and mean. He's legitimated rage and aggression in a lot of different ways. You know, January 6th, he's praising those who were indicted for the break-in as now patriots. In 2020, he had metal detectors removed, saying that it's okay to bring arms to the Capitol. You know, he's made personal attacks to General Mark Milley, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, that he should be executed. So he talks in a more aggressive way, and now we've gotten used to it.
Do you think if Kamala Harris were to win, that the Democrats would now wake up to the things that you have described and the failure of the party to address them in the past? Is there anything kind of that realistically suggests to you that she gets it in a way that Clinton, in a sense Obama as well, didn't?
I think so, yes. I think that the whole Democratic Party has been shaken to its core. They see that they've been asleep, and there have been a huge social trend that I hadn't been tracking, and it's bigger and more important and has been mobilized by a new figure. And I think they've had their wake-up call. And I've had a bunch of calls, actually, from the Democratic Party asking, hey, once we get in, what can we do?
And that was Professor Ali Hochschild talking to me earlier.
It is coming up to a quarter to nine. The government has a goal of decarbonising power generation in the UK by 2030. Currently, just over 50% of our electricity comes from sources such as wind, solar, nuclear, biomass and hydropower. And a report out today from the official body set up after the election to advise on this says that yes, the 2030 goal can be met if infrastructure is built quickly. And that infrastructure includes more than 600 miles of power lines. Fintan Sly is the chief executive of that new body, NESO, the National Energy System Operator. Good morning, Fintan. Welcome.
Good morning.
We should be clear. So those 600 miles of power lines, are they overhead power lines, meaning pylons?
So in the plan, they are, yes. They are alongside also about 4,000 miles of undersea cables and underground cables as well. But in order to connect up the renewable resources that we need in order to get to a clean power system, we need to build out the network infrastructure that's needed to do that. A core part of the report as well is how do we do that and bring people and communities with us? Because we're acutely conscious that building infrastructure pylons does impose on people and communities in their locality. So how do we reform the system such that planning and consenting is more streamlined and we bring people and communities
with
us?
But you want the consents to go ahead, don't you? Without that, this goal can't be met.
Absolutely. In order to build the infrastructure, planning and consenting is a core part of that process. And I think one of the things that we've seen is that we need to be able to streamline how that happens. 2030 in infrastructure terms really isn't that far away. And therefore, the plans that we've looked at are generally things that are already in train. So the 600 miles of pylons that you referred to, the vast majority of those are plans that we set out about 2 years ago. Yeah. So we're already talking to communities about them.
And some of them are really apprehensive about what it means for, you know, communities in the east of England. Are you essentially telling people that this goal is an important one and therefore you have to be prepared for the landscape to change? I presume that within this there'll also be new onshore wind turbines as well as offshore ones being built.
Yeah, so we look across a range of technologies that includes onshore wind, offshore wind, solar, and other clean sources. And yes, getting to clean power is an important objective, and it will require that Great Britain builds infrastructure. What is really important, though, is that we bring people and communities with us on this journey. The transition to a clean power system to get to net zero only works if we can bring society with us. There's huge benefits for businesses, for the economy, for jobs, for investment. But it only works if we have the social license to make that change and bring.
So those who are apprehensive about it, how are you suggesting you bring them along? Is it discounted electricity?
So there are various ways that government had a consultation out around how to make sure that some of the benefit of this infrastructure goes back to those that are most immediately affected, because they are hosting infrastructure that gives significant benefits for the country as a whole, but it is more immediately impacting on them. So there are various, and I don't think there's a one-size-fits-all solution to this that will work for every single community. So cheaper electricity bills, discounts on bills is one thing that's been looked at. Investment in the community, investment in sort of energy efficiency schemes for housing in the areas. They're all options that are being looked at, and it definitely won't be a one-size-fits-all. It must be worked through and be appropriate for the particular communities.
Essentially, this is about taking gas, isn't it, out of the system, out of the power generation system as much as possible, though I think the definition of clean power still includes a little bit of gas for electricity generation.
It is. So the UK electricity system has been on a journey of decarbonisation. It's only 5 weeks ago that we closed the last coal-fired power station, and that used to be the mainstay of the electricity system. To get to clean power by 2030, we need to reduce the amount of gas that's burnt in our power generation facilities and get that down to less than 5%. So it's a really significant reduction in the amount of gas that's used.
Do you also need people to use electricity at non-peak times? Are you actively asking people to do that? Because what about the times when the wind doesn't blow and maybe that little bit of gas is not enough to cushion us at that time?
So we've really looked at this to make sure that the system can be secure and reliable, and holding that gas in strategic reserve, it's used really, really a small percentage of the time, less than 5%, but that does provide you with the security of supply. We do think there's real opportunity for consumers to use their electricity in a different way to help them to reduce their bills. But it's not a requirement that people change in order to ensure that we have a secure system.
Fenton Sly, thank you.
Thank you.
And that brings us to 10 to 9. A big Dutch publisher plans to trial the translating of commercial fiction into English using artificial intelligence. VBK is the largest publisher in the Netherlands, actually acquired by Simon & Schuster earlier this year. They're going to, they say, use AI to assist in the translation of a limited number of books. Rosalind Harvey is on the line, who is a literary translator. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
What do you make of it?
Well, I think there's a sort of combination of a slight sense of inevitability, which is a feeling that a lot of these tech companies seem to have pushed upon us. But amongst colleagues of mine, and I'm including authors in that, not only literary translators, there's a real concern, actually, about where this will lead to. I've read the article, and the article mentions that there will be, for example, one edit of these AI-translated books. Now, unless the editor of these AI-translated books actually speaks the source language, then it's going to be very difficult for them to catch some of the many mistakes that we know AI makes in this kind of work.
Yeah, and it's not just mistakes, I suppose, in the obvious sense of just things that are mistranslated, but a whole lot of subtlety that falls short of mistranslation.
Exactly, yes. I mean, when I say mistranslation, that's kind of what I'm talking about. So what a literary translator, a human literary translator, brings to the job is an awareness not just of how one word might translate into another word, which is essentially how AI works, but of all the nuances. We might talk about the musicality of a text, we might talk about the cultural references that it makes. But the main issue in my eyes is that while AI might look like it can translate, it might look like it can write, what it definitely cannot do is read. And literary translators, first and foremost readers, we read a book. We understand it in its totality, and not only that, we understand it in its context, in its original language, so we can see where it slots in to the literary ecosystem, from where it's come, where it might fit into the new ecosystem, and be able to adapt the cultural references and the language for its new readers. And there's no way that AI can do that.
Thing is, I wonder if this will just underline what you've just said, and actually the books will be rubbish and no one will buy them and they won't do it again. Or at least they'll go away until AI really can do it, which might be sometime in the future.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of overhype around this. I think there's a misunderstanding or a lack of real understanding about actually how good AI is, because it's not really very good. And that's why the publisher is about having to hire an editor. You know, it's going to be an AI sandwich. There's a human author at the start who produces the book, then it gets put through this sausage machine of AI, and then a human editor at the end. But that's a recognition that actually it can't really do a very decent job. Not to mention, you know, the ethical and the environmental issues that the use of AI brings up. We know that it has huge environmental costs, and the way that it's trained is also very ethically dubious.
All right, Rosalind Harvey, thank you very much for talking to us this morning.
8 minutes to 9, four people have been arrested in Poland in an operation that appears to be linked to what the MI5 chief said last month about Russia being on a mission to cause mayhem on European streets, including by arson and sabotage. Also possibly linked to a courier package that burst into flames in a Birmingham warehouse in July. Frank Gardner, our security correspondent, joins us. What is the possible link to that package exploding, Frank, which wasn't reported much at the time?
Good morning, Michelle. Yes, okay, so first of all, we should say that the Russian authorities deny, or the Kremlin rather, denies any involvement or responsibility for this. And quite recently, President Putin has laughed off the suggestion that Russia's GRU military intelligence is, as MI5 claim, trying to cause mayhem across Europe. But what happened on July the 22nd is that a package caught fire at a DHL warehouse in Minworth, which is a suburb of Birmingham. Now, it was put out with, it was dealt with the local fire brigade, but it's now thought that this was connected to another package that caught fire at a warehouse in Leipzig in Germany. And then there were two other packages that the Polish authorities had to deal with. One was intercepted, one caught fire. So you're right, it wasn't. I mean, there was probably a lot of other news going on in the Middle East at the time. But it's now thought that the dots are joining up on this, and that this was part of a coordinated campaign which is suspected of being the work of the GRU, the same Russian spy organization that painted Novichok on the handle of the Skripal's door back in 2018 in Salisbury.
But are these the kinds of devices, like whatever was inside them, that caused them to explode? If that had happened, for example, in the on a courier plane, on a cargo plane, what could they have led to?
Almost certainly the plane crashing. This is why it's really serious. So the new bits that have emerged, as reported in the press, in the papers, is that they contained magnesium or compound of magnesium, which burns incredibly brightly with a white flame and reacts very badly to water. You've got to use special powder to put it out. And if they had exploded, if these had caught fire in midair, then it's very likely, well, certainly the pilot would have had to do a forced landing, but quite possibly they wouldn't be able to put it out. It's the one thing that plane crews always fear is a fire on board, but this would have been a very serious one. It could quite easily have crashed the plane. Now, the assumption that we were told in briefings some time ago, some weeks ago, was that there was a kind of coordinated arson campaign across Europe to just cause mayhem, to mess up logistics, just to make life uncomfortable, as part of something known as hybrid warfare, kind of sub-threshold warfare. But the Polish prosecutors reportedly believe that this was a kind of dummy run for transatlantic flights, for putting packages on planes from Britain and other parts of Europe to the US and Canada. All of this, I should say, is denied by Russia.
Frank Gardner, thanks very much.
And at 9:04, just time to say that Kirsty Young's going to be here and joined by the novelist Irvin Welsh are on the latest episode of Young Again, and also a word to say that you can follow the latest news for the US election on the live news stream of BBC Sounds. It's from 10 o'clock tonight. Roz Atkins, Nuala McGovern, going to be here throughout the night, and of course on Radio 4 with the America Decides Results programme. And I think there's a podcast, Michelle, called AmeriCast, which will have, dozens of emergency editions.
Yes, we'll be working you round the clock. But in the little time we have before 9 o'clock, Justin, you've covered many US elections. How has this one felt to you as you've talked to voters?
Oh, the place is angrier than it used to be. I covered the Obama election and George W. Bush's re-election as well. And in both of those, I mean, at the time, a lot of people said an awful lot depends on it, because we always say about that about American elections. Americans themselves always say about American elections. But there is this sense on both sides. That's the interesting thing, I think, here. And when you talk to people, you realise on the Trump side as well, there are a lot of people who really do feel that the future of the country, and genuinely feel, not just in a sort of performative way, actually feel that the country would be quite damaged by Kamala Harris being elected, and that sort of fissure is there. But at the same time, I have to say, we talk to Trump supporters who say, you know what, we'd be fine if she's elected. It's not the end of the world. There is a sort of division between the way in which the political class talk about each other and their opponents, and particularly the way all of it happens on social media, and the kind of actually just ordinary way in which Americans live their lives and still rub along in a way that just isn't reflected, I don't think, in a lot of our coverage, actually.
But there's also the reality and the knowledge of what happened on January the 6th that year. And so do you think it is at least a possibility we can't rule out that whatever the result, there is going to be unrest or possibly worse?
This is what the New York Times is reporting this morning, that on the Telegram channels, so this is effectively a social media channel, but closed channels or relatively closed channels, there are people, including this secretive group, the Proud Boys, who are planning already for potential violence. The issue is, I mean, there are always people in America, there are groups of people who are at least threatened to use violence, and individuals, of course, who do use violence. The unknown thing, I suppose, is the extent to which they would be ready in the event of a close result and Kamala Harris winning, even just winning 270 votes, which is the bare minimum, but even just getting a few more than that, whether they would then take to the streets and worse. And that is something that I think it's reasonable to say at the moment is unknown. I thought it was quite striking when we talked to Brian Lanza, the Trump supporter and Trump confidant earlier in the program. He absolutely didn't take Nigel Farage's advice and say if he loses, he should just give up.
Lots more coverage. Well, Justin is presenting from Washington not only tomorrow but the next day as well, and of course multiple ways on the BBC to keep up with our coverage in this crucial